I'm Greg Kokel from Stand to Reason, and I'm wearing blue jeans today because this is a working class session on apologetics. I'm going to roll up my sleeves here a little bit because what we're going to be doing in the next 4 hours or so is talking about creating a bridge from the content to the conversation, a bridge from the scholarship to the relationship. And this is something that's often missing in conferences like this, where you have lots of brilliant apologetics teachers, great minds who have worked out the difficult problems, and you can sit in class and kind of get the stuff, but how do you take the stuff that you get from the smart guys and work it into a conversation so that it's productive in man on the street, shoes on the ground kind of apologetics? And that's what our session is all about. Now, I'm the founder and president of an organization. I mentioned the name a few moments ago, Stand to Reason. Let me just write the website up here because you can get it all over the world. Stand to Reason, acronym is STR. If you go to str.org, not only are there 1,000 pages of content on our website, downloadable for free, many of them having to do with much of what I'm going to be talking about this afternoon, the tactical approach to engaging people. Well, of course, the right term is apologetics, but I don't like the word apologetics or even evangelism for what we do and what we do at Stand to Reason, and I'll explain why that's the case in just a moment. But a lot of what I'm talking about, you can find details of for free to download on our website. You can go to YouTube, and I've done a lot of presentations that have to do with this broader material and other things as well. Plus, I've written a book called Tactics, same title as the seminar, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. Zondervan published it. It's available in the bookstore. In fact, I borrowed this copy. I had to promise I'd bring it back, but I told him I've already read it, so I'm probably not going to keep it. Zondervan keeps sending me a new copy every time they do another run, which means I just got my 11th copy last week because they've just finished the 11th printing of this book. But you may want to consider getting this. I don't know your particular roles in your your spiritual community in Europe, if you're a pastor, a teacher, or instructor, a Bible study leader, whatever, but the same material that we have in the book is also available on DVD. Now, you have to get it from us in the States, and so there's maybe some costs involved there. But the reason I mention that is what I hope to see happen is not only will I give you some tools that will help you as an individual person make a difference as an ambassador for Christ in Europe, but you'll be able to transfer some of these concepts, especially if you have the video where you just get plug and play. You know, there's a workbook that comes with it, and you can lead a group in some of these things that many people have found to be very, very helpful, even transforming in helping them to engage their culture with the claims of Christ, but in a winsome and attractive fashion. Now, I've been doing talk radio, interactive talk radio, for 23 years now. I've also spoken on more than 60 college and university campuses around the States, some overseas. The reason I mention that is to make the point that the things that I'm going to be talking about today have been tested in the marketplace of ideas. And they've been really proven to be effective and useful in a blue jeans kind of feet on the ground kind of fashion. I mentioned a moment ago a problem that we have is we're learning apologetics and all of the answers to the things from the smart guys, and I go to a lot of these conferences, especially in the States. They have a lot of them, which is really great. There's a resurgence of apologetics in the States, and it's great to see this kind of spreading to Europe because it's really necessary in light of the demands and the challenges of the secular culture. But the difficulty of a lot of these conferences, just what I said, is that people get their head filled with information and they don't know where to go with it. And so a lot of times they invite me, come on in. They invite me to come in at the end and give the final presentation to make this transition, to provide a bridge, to give a game plan that helps the rank and file people in the conference to take the information that they've had and to try to get this into play. And so I'm going to give you a game plan It's called the tactical approach. That's what we call it here at Stand to Reason. And this is what we spend 4 hours today kind of going in much more detail. And I want to do my best as a trainer, as a workshop leader here to help you take some of these concepts and get them into play. There's going to be a couple little group interaction things that I'll have, but I'll be open for Q&A too. And it's a smaller environment, so we'll be able to talk a little bit. If you have questions about particulars, I'll give you opportunity throughout our session today to ask questions. So I'm going to give you a game plan. Before I get to this, I want to say something that might be surprising to many of you, which is foundational to my approach. It's a discovery I made about 6 or 7, maybe 8 years ago now, and it's just been kind of maturing in my own thinking. When I tell you this, you might find it surprising. In fact, when I tell this to audiences, they're given that a lot of times people associate evangelism and apologetics together, when they hear what I'm about to tell you, they're a bit surprised. And I've even had some religious leaders push back very hard on this. They didn't like it. But I'm going to stand behind it for a good reason. And here it is. I never have it as a goal, when I encounter another person that I want to have a spiritual kind of conversation with, whether I'm sitting next to them on an airplane or whether I'm in the grocery market or wherever you happen to run into people and try to be available to the Lord to have conversations, I never have it as a goal to lead that person to Christ. In fact, I don't even have it as a goal to get to the cross. And the reason this is surprising is when you take an evangelism course, maybe in your church or online or whatever, and you get good instruction on things, but sometimes the teachers will say things like this. They'll say, you know, these tools are helpful, but if you only have 5 minutes, if you just have a short amount of time, just get right to the gospel. Give them the most important thing, which is the gospel, because you may not have a chance to speak to them again. Now, I agree with them that this is the most important thing. But there's a presumption when people say, just get right to the gospel. One of the presumptions is that the gospel is going to be clear enough in a 5-minute presentation for the people to even make sense of it. As Nancy Piercy has recently written, the simple gospel is no longer simple. These terms do not mean anything. We talk about Jesus as being Lord and Savior and trusting Him and believing Him, all of these things. This is spiritual gobbledygook to people. This is spiritual noise. It's like flight attendant noise. You know, when you get in the airplane and you hear the flight attendant, what does the flight attendant say? She says blah, 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 blah. Because nobody had ever listening, right? And I call it flight attendant noise. And if anybody's a flight attendant, no offense intended, but this is the way, you know, he's sitting in the... And by the same token, though, when we go out in the community and we begin talking to people about our own convictions... And by the way, notice I didn't say our own faith, because the word faith is another one of those spiritual gobbledygook words that people just go over their head. So we'll talk about this more, but I try to find substitute words. So when I go out and talk about my convictions about spiritual things, I avoid this kind of language, this noise, because it doesn't make sense to people. So if you are told, just take 5 minutes, get to the foot of the cross, this presumes that the things that you're able to say in 5 minutes will make sense to people. That's one problem. Here's another problem. These people, even if they are not big readers, they've probably been exposed enough to people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and Peter Singer and Bart Ehrman and a whole host of people that are really smart people that have written books that are bestsellers that you see in the airport, you see them on talk shows and TV, and maybe they don't understand all the ideas, but they know those guys are smart and they're not Christians. In fact, they're against Christianity and theism. And so there must be some really, really good reasons not to take this stuff seriously. So this is in the back of their mind. And you kind of waltz out there with the simple gospel. There's all of this brush in the way, keeping them from taking what you have to say seriously at all. This is just spiritual wishful thinking to them. This is just your fantasies. So that's another barrier if you're just going to get to the simple gospel. Here's the third thing. If I told you, like a lot of evangelism teachers might say, says, if you only have 5 minutes, just go out, Your goal is to get to the gospel. Your goal is to win these people to Christ. You'd sit there as an audience and you'd nod and you'd smile and you'd dutifully take notes, and then you wouldn't do it because it scares you. If you think that you have to try to convert every conversation into a witnessing that gets to the cross and at least exposes them to the claims of Christ in some full-bodied way, this is just too frightening for the rank and file. And the more aggressive and hostile the secular culture is, the more frightening it is. And I'm sympathetic to that. You know, I'm a trained professional. And, you know, and it isn't without some fear and trembling that I think about addressing the culture. All right? So because of those problems, I have adopted a different goal in my conversations. And so I'm going to commend this goal to you as a goal that is more within reach for the rank and file, and not just for you as individuals, but all of those that you represent, that you may be training as a result of the training that you received here. And I express this goal specifically whenever I address a university audience. I tell them, it's basically the first words out of my mouth, I tell them, I'm here tonight because my life has been deeply changed by an ancient teacher. His name is Jesus of Nazareth. And as a student at UCLA nearly 40 years ago now, I began to give careful consideration to the claim that Jesus made about himself, about reality, and about the claim he had on my own life. And I thought about it for a long time. And slowly it began to occur to me, and I became convinced that Jesus got it right, that he saw the world the way it really was. And then I realized that the smartest thing that I could do, a guy who thought he was too smart to be a Christian, the smartest thing I could do was to fall in behind Jesus and to follow him. And I've been doing that for almost 40 years, and I've been doing the best I can. It's not always been easy, I tell the audience, but at the same time, I'm trying to help other people to see what I saw and to follow him as well, because I think it matters. But I tell them, notice, by the way, so far, no Christian lingo, no spiritual gobbledygook, no religious noise. I found substitute words to say all kinds of things that Christians normally say, but do it in a different manner so it sounds fresh to them. But I said, I'm not here to convert you. That's not my goal tonight. I have a different goal. What I want to do is I just want to put a stone in your shoe. All right? I just want to annoy you in a good way by something that I've said. I want you walking out of here kind of hobbling out, scratching your head, thinking about what something that I've said, because I am convinced that Christianity is worth thinking about. And then off I go, and I start my lecture or my talk or whatever it happens to be. But notice what I'm shooting for, and I'm up front with them. I announce it. I'm just trying to get them to think. And so my perspective here for myself and for you and for the body of Christ is an encouragement. You don't have to swing for the fences. American metaphor from baseball. You don't have to, you know, to hit a home run. You don't have to... You don't even have to get on base as far as I'm concerned. I just want you to get in the batter's box. And I have a technique that will teach you to do that. It's the tactical approach. It's a way of managing conversations. In fact, my promise to you is that I would like to give you a game plan. And because we have more time, I can give it to you in some detail. Not like the 20-minute blurb we had this morning. I'd like to give you a game plan that will allow you to converse with confidence in any situation, no matter how little you know. And it may be that you know very little. You may be a brand new Christian. That's probably not the case for people here, but in terms of the application of this plan, you could be a brand new Christian. No matter how little you think you know, or how aggressive or educated or articulate the other person happens to be, you can still maneuver gracefully and effectively in virtually any conversation using the plan that I want to suggest. Now, let me give you an illustration of how this worked out for me. I just returned about, what is today, Friday? Less than a week ago from northern Wisconsin. Now, I live in the West Coast. Northern Wisconsin's in the Midwest. But I grew up in Chicago. And so my grandfather, who was also from that area, had been a lumberjack in Wisconsin. He bought some property in northern Wisconsin, which is really pretty. There's no mountains there, but there's all woods and a lot of lakes. And I went up there as a kid and fished during the summers. And so now, as an adult, though I live on the West Coast, which is 2,000 miles away, I still journey out there at least once a summer. And if I'm able to, I take my children. I have little girls I'll tell you about in a moment. But I relax and I do some fishing. I just was there by myself for the earliest fishing season, which is cold and rainy, but also very good fishing. But on this particular trip out, I had caught the largest smallmouth bass of my life. It's a game fish. Again, I guess they have bass in Europe, but probably that's not the popular game fish. In any event, just take my word, that one. 4 pounds, 2 ounces was a big fish. Now, I caught a 5 pound, 13 ounce one last week. That was my personal best. So I'm way past that. But at the time, I was so excited about this fish, and I was with the local pastor at the time. And so I got a photograph of the fish, and I wanted to get it digitized so I could show it on the screen at that pastor's church the following Sunday where I was going to be teaching. So I'm on vacation, but I still, you know, teach at the local church, and you know, we kind of have a tradition there. I want to show them what a fisherman I was, right? Well, we took the film in. This is before my digital days, you know. We took the film in to get it digitized, and the young lady who was standing at the counter was wearing a five-pointed cross, a star, around her neck. It was a large piece of jewelry, you know, and, you know, five-pointed star, pentagram, is an occultic symbol in many cases. So I noticed it, and I asked her. I said, "Does that jewelry have any religious significance?" And she said, "Yes, it does. I'm a pagan." And my dear wife, standing next to me, broke into laughter when the lady said she was a pagan. And then she caught herself. She said, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be rude, but I just never heard anybody actually admit it before, you know." She'd only heard the word pagan used when my wife's girlfriends would call their kids in. "Get in here, you bunch of pagans," you know, that kind of thing. And so the lady wasn't offended. She said, "Well, we're an earth religion," and she began to explain some of the ideas, and suddenly I realized I'm talking to a witch. Indeed, I asked her, "So then you're Wiccan?" And she said, "Yes, that's right." And she explained, "We respect all life," which is a basic tenet of Wicca. And I thought, well, and in fact, I said this. I said, "Well, if you respect all life, that would probably make you pro-life with regards to the abortion question, wouldn't it?" Now, it's my understanding, by the way, that most witches are pro-life for that reason. Go figure. But she said, "No, I'm actually pro-choice." And I said, "Isn't it odd for a witch to be pro-choice?" And she goes, "Well, it is kind of." And then she qualified. She said, "I know," this was her exact words. She said, "I know I could never do that. I could never kill a baby." Her words, not mine. Now, I actually think abortion takes the life of an innocent human child. Baby killing, if you will. But I don't use that language when I'm trying to persuade somebody. Because I don't want them to think that I'm using rhetorically loaded language to try to manipulate them. I'm going to use different language. But now, I'm not the one who's using baby killing language. Who is using it? The witch from Wisconsin. The pro-choicer. And if you get nothing else out of our time together today, I hope one thing you get is an ability to listen. You see the importance of listening to what other people say. I was reading Proverbs last night. Proverbs, what's today? The 19th. So it was the 18th. And it says, a person who gives an answer before he listens is a fool. That's what one of the Proverbs said. Something like that. Paraphrase, but you get the idea. I thought that's appropriate for what I'm going to say today. Because I was listening to her, and because I was listening to her and I wasn't thinking about what I'm going to say next, I'm listening, she gave me something. She gave me, it isn't even a tacit admission, but a explicit admission that abortion kills babies. So in this conversation now, as it continues, am I going to refer to, am I going to use the word abortion anymore in talking about this issue? No, I'm not going to use that term. I'm going to use her term. I'm going to talk about baby killing because she's already introduced it. She says, I know I could never do that. I could never kill a baby. And then she gave the reason why. She said, I wouldn't want something bad to come back on me, is what she said. Now, this is, I don't know if that strikes you as unusual, but it's kind of like a karma thing. What goes around comes around, you know. And her idea was, man, I'm not going to kill any babies. You never know what's going to happen to you if you start killing babies. You know what I'm saying? That strikes me as an odd reason not to kill babies. Maybe we just shouldn't kill babies regardless. You know, in any event, I didn't pursue that, but I thought that. Instead, I said, well, maybe you won't kill babies, but maybe we should stop other people from killing babies. She said, well, I think people should have a choice. Now, what is the choice that we're talking about here? The choice to do what? To kill babies. And in fact, that's what I said. You mean people should be allowed to kill babies? And she said, well, I think, remember, this is her term now, not mine, so I'm not cheating at all. She said, well, you know, I think all things should be taken into consideration. And I said, all right, what would be a legitimate consideration to make it okay to kill a baby? And she immediately said incest. Now, I want you to see what's going on here. Just to step back from this conversation for a moment. For one, please notice that we are not having an argument. There are no lines drawn in the sand. We're having a friendly conversation. I'm just kind of following her lead and responding to the things she's saying and drawing her out and listening, paying attention. But she has been repeating essentially pro-choice slogans without paying attention to what she's saying. Because having given the admission that abortion is baby killing, she is now using slogans explicitly in defense of baby killing. Well, I think people should be allowed to kill babies. Well, they should have a choice. Well, I think all things should be taken into consideration in killing babies. I mean, do you realize how ridiculous this is beginning to sound? So I'm not raising my eyebrows or rolling my eyes or anything like that. I'm just following this thing. And so I said, let me ask you a question. Now, I didn't have any children at that point. Now I have two little girls. I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. I started a little bit late, in case you were wondering. In two weeks, I'll be 62. So I can use your prayers! I have 7 and 4. They're really good little kids, you know, and my wife is a great mom with the girls. So, you know, it's probably as easy as it can be for a guy like me. But I know what you're thinking. Some people say, wait until they become teenagers. And I say, well, if I'm lucky, I'll be dead by then. I got it all worked out. But I couldn't have used my 4-year-old as an example then. But what I said to the witch is, I said, well, what if I had a 2-year-old standing next to me right here? Which 2-year-old had been conceived by incest? Both of our children are adopted from crisis pregnancies. Not through incest, but, you know, these kinds of things happen. So that child would have fulfilled your demand there. Then, on your view, I should be allowed to kill this baby. Is that right? Now, by the way, is that a fair application of her view? What do you think? She said all things should be taken into consideration. Okay, what? Well, incest, that's a legitimate reason to kill a baby. So if I have a 2-year-old here who is conceived by incest, wouldn't that 2-year-old qualify on her view? Yeah, sure. I wasn't being unfair. And that's the point when she stopped to think. And she paused for a long time because what we're looking at is the logical implications of the view that she's promoting. Well, that is that. And finally she said, I'd have mixed feelings about that. And I'm thinking, mixed feelings? Well, at least I hope so, you know, minimally mixed. And she said it as a concession. It was kind of like, well, you got a point there. gee, golly whiz. By the way, at this point, the line is increasing behind me, all right? So I'm interfering now with her work product, which means my opportunity is over with. Now, I didn't say, hold on, folks, I haven't gotten to the gospel yet. Sit down, maybe you'll learn something. No, I realized the limitations of circumstances like this, and I was not committed to get to the foot of the cross. I was committed to following what I had, whatever it is that the Holy Spirit gave me, and just do what I could. Because my point of view now, my perspective, is not that I'm an evangelist or even an apologist. That's not how I see myself in those circumstances. Instead, I see myself as an ambassador. An ambassador, okay? Ambassador, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 20. And in 2 Corinthians 5:20, Paul says, we are ambassadors for Christ. As though God were speaking through us, Paul says, we beg of you on behalf of Christ be reconciled to God. So Paul saw himself and all followers of Christ really in this role, of, in the ministry of reconciliation is what he's talking about there at the end of 2 Corinthians 5. That we play a role of standing in between two parties, the sovereign who we represent to a people who don't see the sovereign. They see us. So when I'm going into a circumstance, I'm thinking of myself ambassador. Not evangelist, close the deal. Not evangelist, harvest the fruit. Not even apologist, defend the faith so much. It may work in there. I'm thinking about representative. Diplomat. Being a diplomatic representative of Christ. In Colossians chapter 4, verses like 2 through 5, somewhere in there, if you want a reference, you can check it later. But here's what Paul says. Conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity, seasoning your words with salt, as it were, so that you know how to respond to each person. And you see, the tactical approach that I want to suggest is a kind of approach that allows you to follow Paul's admonition to treat people as individuals. Even though you have a somewhat fixed game plan in your mind, it has the flexibility in it to be able to respond to each person as the circumstances present itself. You can be alert to the individual circumstances and move forward if there's opportunity, or back off if they're not. Now, I know there are various sensibilities about this with individuals. Some people are much, much more aggressive than I am even. Some people are a lot less aggressive. I think you should find your niche. I don't think we all have to be exactly the same. We have different personalities. And here's one way that I think about it. I think about it like, and this goes back to my putting a stone in their shoe. If you think about the whole process of someone coming to Christ, and I don't know in your circumstances, and maybe I should ask in a few moments where you're coming from, but I became a Christian as an adult. So there was a season for me of reflection, consideration, asking questions, sometimes in a hostile way. Before I really sunk my teeth into this. And it wasn't, though my brother was the main person who kind of walked me through this, my younger brother, who's now a pastor, who led me to Christ. There were other people that were in the mix. Point being, there were different ambassadors that God used to help move me along. It wasn't just one person in one moment in time. It was over a period of time with multiple people. And if you think about what Paul says in First Corinthians, I think it is, he says, I planted, Apollo watered, but God caused the increase. I want you to see in this kind of an agricultural metaphor that there is a process here. There is a planting, stone in the shoe, planting a seed, however you want to call it. There is a growth of this plant, and different people are making contribution. Then there is a time of harvesting. Now, probably there's always a harvest somewhere. But in any individual person's life, the harvest is almost always preceded by a season of development. Okay? So when you are encountering some individual, you don't know where they are in terms of, you don't know if you're just planting the first seed, you don't know if you're watering something that has come before, you don't know if they're ready for harvest. And if we're thinking evangelism, we're thinking harvesting. And I don't think, when you think about agriculture, most of the work isn't in the harvesting. Most of the work comes beforehand. And since most of the work comes beforehand, most of the workers are working at gardening, not at harvesting. But I think a lot of times in our Christian communities, we are focused on, or our focus is placed on the harvest, and then we are feeling bad because we're not harvesting. Well, maybe you're not a harvester. Maybe you're a gardener. I don't consider myself a harvester. I don't lead a lot of people to Christ. Not directly. I think of myself as a gardener. I'm just there to help things along. And this fits nicely with the ambassador motif. But I have a plan. And notice in this conversation with the witch in Wisconsin that I asked 9 different questions actually in the conversation. That whole conversation is in the book on tactics. I asked questions to get the conversation going. I had questions to get more information. I used questions to help make a point that there's something maybe questionable about the view that she holds. And at this point in the talk, I used to say, and she was doing all the work, not me. Well, I really wasn't doing any work. But she wasn't doing any work either. She was relaxed. It wasn't like she was on the defensive or anything like that, and I'm cool and calm and all that. No, it was just a friendly conversation. It was pleasant. That's what I'm after. All right. Now, at this point, I want to pause just for a moment, and I'd like you, we have kind of roughly 2 groups here, I'd like you just to talk with each other about 2 or 3 minutes, just reflecting together on this idea of putting a stone in the shoe as opposed to harvesting, focus, the focus of harvesting, okay? And what you think about that, you know, and how this makes you feel, or does this open up new avenues for you, or does it give you more confidence? I don't know. Maybe you disagree with it, and that's okay too. But don't tell me about it. I want you to talk with each other. Just take a few minutes and talk about this idea, and reflect on it a little bit as a group, and then we'll come back and we'll do a group exercise after that. I'd like you to do a little exercise here, and I'm not going to assess it. I want to hear your answers to it, but you're going to need to get back into groups. And what I'm going to do, I'm not going to assess it because I want to revisit the exercise after a couple of hours of instruction. I just want to see what your response to this exercise would be now, and I want you to be able to reflect on it. I'm going to give you a situation. We have 2 groups. I have 4 situations, and 1 situation is very germane to American culture, so I'm not going to use that. I'm going to give 3 situations to 2 groups. That means you're both going to get 1 of them together and give me your separate answers, and you'll also have a separate one. So each will have 2 things to deal with. And it's the kind of situations that you may run into. And we call this a 30-second window. And the reason we call it a 30-second window is if you can imagine when you're in a circumstance like I'll read to you, something happens and an opportunity presents itself. You have a small window of opportunity to respond, or else the moment passes, and then people are on to something else. And the question is, how will you use your 30 seconds? Given the illustration or the circumstance that I'll read to you for your individual problems, what do you say? What do you do next? How do you turn this into a productive opportunity? For something spiritual, not necessarily getting to the foot of the cross, but how do you take advantage of this? So let me read the first scene to you, and you will both deal with the first scene. And you can talk about it for about 5 minutes, and then I'll give you a time, and then you can go to the second scene, all right? In fact, I'm thinking that it might be better for me just to read the first scene to you now and then have you work in it with, and then give you the second scene afterwards so you're not confused by too many scenes at once. So here's the situation. You're hosting a dinner party at your home for some of your close friends from church. The conversation ranges naturally over a number of interesting spiritual topics, and suddenly, to your surprise and embarrassment, your 15-year-old son announces with some belligerence, anger, that he doesn't believe in God anymore, that he's an atheist. It's simply not rational, he says. There's no proof. You had no idea he'd been moving in this direction. There's a stunned and embarrassed silence. What will you say? Now, this, I actually should make this as not your son, because there's other emotional elements in there, but let's just say you're at the party and this happens. This actually happened to me. I was at the home of a friend who is a very well-known religious leader in the States, and his son, sitting across from me at the table, announced to the whole party that he was an atheist, and with some attitude, too. And there's no, it's irrational to believe in God. There are no good reasons for God. It's just, there's no proof, is what he said. So, now I want you to discuss as a group here, if you were at the dinner party, what would you say to him? In that first 30 seconds, how would you try to capture the moment to use it productively for Christ? I'll give you 5 minutes each as a group. Go ahead. All right. Why don't you just kind of face this direction? I'm curious what you came up with in terms of how you would deal with someone at a party where you think it's all Christians and someone announces they're an atheist and says, the reason is there's no proof, there's no good reason, it's irrational to be a theist. What'd you come up with here? I know you came up with something because I heard a lot of conversation.
Different ideas, or we try to ask him questions. Why do you say this?
Why do you say this, right?
Yeah, or another attitude would be maybe he doesn't want to talk. Let's try to ask him to. Can we see each other this evening to talk about this?
Uh huh.
In 30 seconds.
Incidentally, just for clarification, you have 30 seconds not to resolve the issue, but 30 seconds to set the direction of the conversation is my point. Sorry if I wasn't clear on that. So, yeah, and it might be good to have more conversation and another time with him about it, but in those first 30 seconds, this is where you can maybe get the conversation moving in a productive direction. You were going to say something else?
Can you say you will do
it? Yeah, I was just thinking probably the number one thing I want to show in my response is that I'm not afraid of his questions. So
yeah,
to actually just embrace it and go, those are fantastic questions you're asking. I'm really glad you're asking them. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about mm-hmm. that. Because he's just trying to launch a bomb and
yeah,
he don't let it explode.
But he hasn't asked any questions, though. He's made statements in this particular case.
There are
case.
Questions with a statement.
Yeah,
so I'm
there
just
going to immediately
issues. Treat it as a question,
uh-huh,
even if he's not asking one, because that's how I want the conversation
okay.
to go.
Okay, good.
Everybody's talking except
the
child.
Pardon me?
Everybody's talking about this God question except the teenager.
It was a surprising situation, of course. How about you guys? What'd you come up with? Bob? Robert?
Well,
I don't know what you could
what did we come up with? I think we had lots of different points of view on it. What's the underlying issue there? You know, and why is he kind of angry, or why is he kind of attacking? Is he really wanting to talk about the issue? I mean, is he provoking? Does he want someone to take the issue of, let me defend the existence of God? I mean, we're just kind of talking about the motivations. Michael was saying, just thanking him, thank you for your honesty. And so, what do you guys?
Yeah, I mean, thought there may be an issue that he's observed something as hypocrisy and that he doesn't like, and
mm-hmm.
this is his response to it.
Mm-hmm.
So dealing with his statements isn't going to help him particularly.
Unless if there's some other thing going on in his mind that's animating this or motivating this, right?
Yeah, he's angry.
He was angry, there's
probably
no question about that.
with his parents and their faith. It may be his parents themselves, or it may be just...
I mean, it was a bit of a mystery, and I know you guys are talking about this, is why he chose this particular occasion to make his announcement, because it was obviously embarrassing to his father, you know, who took it in stride with great... He kind of shrugged. He said, I was the same way when I was a teenager. That's what he said. But one wonders if maybe he was just covering up his own embarrassment. But yeah, there's some... What else is going on here that's motivating this particular issue? Okay, good. Let me give you the next problem. And let's start here. It's the night of your weekly Bible study group. And during the discussion of the Sunday sermon on the Great Commission, a newcomer in the group says, well, who are we to say that Christianity is any better than any other religion? I think the essence of Jesus' teaching is love, the same as all religions, and not telling other people how to live their life or how to believe. We shouldn't be doing that. Now, the rest of the group is now fidgets awkwardly. Now what? So what will you say? So this is your problem. Wait with it. I'll give them their problem. You're riding in the university shuttle in a bus with a friend who notices that you have a Bible in your backpack. Oh, I've read the Bible before, he says. It's got some interesting stories, but people take it way too seriously. It was only written by men, after all, and men make mistakes. You try to recall the points that your pastor made a few weeks ago about the Bible's inspiration, but you come up empty-handed. So now what do you say? Okay, that's your mission, if you choose to accept it. And why don't you spend 5 minutes or so each talking about your respective challenge, and then we'll have some feedback when we're done. All right. Let's start with your question first. This is the broader issue of religious pluralism, which is huge. It's not just huge in culture in general, but it's also a problem within the church, which is why I set this question in the Bible study, because it will not be uncommon for you to encounter this problem amongst people, it seems, who should know better. So in the situation in your Bible study where someone said, who are we to say that Christianity is better than any other religion? I think the essence of Jesus' teaching is love, not telling people how to believe or how to act. Basically, Christianity is like all the other religions anyway. What did you come up with in terms of a response? If anything.
Well, exclusivity of Christianity.
Pardon me?
It's not exclusivity.
Exclusivity. The challenge is on the exclusivity of Christianity.
But it's not we're saying that Jesus is the only way. Jesus said he is the only way. And if he doesn't like it, he should talk with Jesus because he
I actually am very fond. I'm very fond of that response because I think it is a very fair point. You know, this isn't our idea. It's Jesus' idea. We're following him. We say what he says. Yeah, so that's good. And what else?
I will not debate about Christianity being the supremacy or something like this. I will just go with what Francis Assisi said once, love God and do whatever you want. Because everything you will do will please God. Because in terms of pleasing God,
Could you say that again? I'm sorry, I didn't follow it. You mentioned Francis Assisi, right?
Yeah, he has a saying, love God and do whatever you want.
Oh, okay.
And of course, what you will do is something that pleases God. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
anything else?
If he or she, you know, claims that Christianity is all about love. Okay, but what kind of love?
Yeah.
Deadly love. Yeah.
What is? Yeah.
So we can go to that.
Love rejoices in truth, right? Okay. Good. How about you? Oh, did you have more? I'm sorry.
Especially when we are in a study Bible group,
yeah.
people it's assumed that they have a personal experience with God. When you testify the reality of God in your personal life, mm-hmm. it's not just about debating about who and
right.
what. You don't try to impose into anyone else's life. You just share your experience with mm-hmm. people who say, wow, this is not just stories. This mm-hmm. is real.
Yeah. Testimonies can be really, really powerful. There's also this other concern, though, and I'm just going to say this about it, is that part of the challenge is that of religious pluralism is Christians can have their testimonies and they can have their belief system, and that's all fine as long as they don't act like other people have to have the similar kind of thing. So there's an additional problem here. Personal testimonies are really powerful, and I think it's appropriate to share those in those circumstances. Keep in mind, though, it may not be enough, because the person who's the pluralist, who's the religious pluralist, is going to say, well, that's good for you. But acting like I have to believe that way is a different thing. Go ahead. Yes.
When I don't know how, but when you share in such a way your reality with God, that you would steer him to one more, to see that in all those other yeah. pluralism that he says he believes in, he cannot find, or he won't find
right.
what you have in your, and right. you would say, okay, I will throw away all those and I want what you have.
Yeah.
Because it's dead.
Well, you're right. Paul gave his testimony three times, I think, in the book of Acts. It's recorded, so he probably did it even more than that. So it's very powerful to do that, yeah. What did you guys come up with for the Bible issue? Well, I've read the Bible before. It's got some nice stories, but people take it too seriously. It's only written by men. Men make mistakes. You guys are passing the buck here.
I mean, there were various different ideas we were showing. Some guys wanted to get into the philosophical arguments that the pastor had shared, which you've forgotten.
Oh, that's right. I specified. Couldn't remember the arguments and inspiration, right.
But personally, I think you should find out, well, what is the message of the Bible that you think is just human writings and not right? Be specific. It was lots of generalizations.
Right.
Tell me more specifically, and you can actually find out whether he knows anything.
Right.
He may know nothing.
Uh-huh. That's right. Actually, that's a good point. A lot of people talk about the Bible as if they know what it means, and they've never even really given it consideration. Yeah, good. Anything else?
I think that was just the main thing, that putting it back upon him, he's saying, oh, it's just written by men, it's just a bunch of nice stories. He may know all the nice stories, he may know the Bible, but does he know the message of the Bible?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to bring him to a point of, is he able to communicate what the message is? Does mm-hmm. he know what he's rejecting?
Right, yeah. Okay. Anything else?
The philosophical side.
Oh.
if it's written by man, there's two responses there. In certain cases, there are issue or things that men write that we take to be the truth, and we trust
yeah.
them when they say it. And the Bible should be treated like other documents. And
right.
also is the self-destructive option, where if you're a man and if you're saying this,
yeah.
Does that mean that I can have yeah. a similar doubt?
The point he's making is, if they're one of them, the last one is, if you can never trust what men say or write, then you can't even trust that statement, because it's coming from a human being who is fallible by nature, you know, is the way. And so there are some problems with that. Yeah, that's a very good observation. Well, this was just a little exercise to get you thinking about what you do in a circumstance like this, because what I'm going to do from now on is I'm going to give you a plan that you can put in place when circumstances like this come up, right? And I'm going to give you the essence of what we call the tactical approach. Now, it stands to reason, we use lots of different tactics. They have different names, like suicide and taking the roof off and just the facts, ma'am, and road scholar and steamroller. These are all different maneuvers that are actually meant to serve a more precise game plan. And one tactic is central to that. It's the easiest tactic to learn. It's the most flexible one, because it can be used with other tactics. It is essentially our game plan, and it's the simplest way to stop a challenger in their tracks, to turn the tables, to get you in the driver's seat, which is where you want to be, and to get the other person thinking. And the tactic has a name, and it's called Columbo. Now, I don't know if that name Columbo means anything to you. Some of you are grinning, so I know that you're familiar with the American TV icon, Lieutenant Columbo. And I've been in a number of places. I was in Italy not too long ago. Last 2 years ago, I was in Egypt, and a few years before that in the Ukraine, and everybody knew who Columbo was. So Columbo is a detective who shows up in the crime scene with a trench coat. Now, I don't have a trench coat, so you're going to have to use your imagination. The brown trench coat, right? All wrinkled, looks like he slept in it, you know? And he usually shows up with a cigar. I usually use a plastic one. I forgot mine, so I had to buy one of these downstairs. This is a real one, which I hate these things. So after I'm done, I'm going to destroy this by fire. Columbo has a pad of paper, but he can't use his pad of paper. Why not? He doesn't have a pen or pencil, so he's got to bum a pencil off of somebody because he's not prepared. In fact, he shows up at the crime scene, and he's mumbling and muttering to himself and scratching himself on the head. And this guy doesn't look like he can think his way out of a wet paper bag, which I just realized that's probably an Americanism that doesn't make sense to a lot of you. He looks stupid, let's put it that way. But he's stupid like a fox because he's got a plan. And at some point, he'll stop, and he'll put his hand on his hip and his other hand to his forehead, and he'll say something like this. I don't know. There's something about this thing that bothers me. Do you mind if I ask you a question? You know how he does that, right? It looks better with the trench coat, trust me. So he asks the question, and he gets the answer back. Oh, you're very intelligent. One more thing. And then he one more tings him to death, right? With question after question after question. And they get all annoyed. And he says, I'm sorry, it's because I'm asking all these questions, but I can't help it. It's a habit. And this is a habit that you ought to get into. The key to the Columbo tactic is that the Christian goes on the offensive in an inoffensive way by using carefully selected questions to move the conversation forward. Let me say that again. The key to the Columbo tactic, and therefore to your game plan for maneuvering in all of these circumstances, like the circumstances I just described in the 30-second window, the key is using questions. Now, there are lots of things that can be done, lots of things that can be said, and many of you suggested them for your individual responses to these things. I'm just going to suggest the simplest way that I know of and the most effective way across the board to take advantage of those moments, and that's to use the Columbo tactic. That's to ask questions. Now, why use questions? Well, there's a couple of reasons. For one, when you're asking questions of other people, you are drawing them out. You are letting them do the talking. And when they're doing the talking, you're not. You're not under pressure because you're not talking. They are. You're listening, hopefully. And you are showing courtesy to them by the way you're treating them. When somebody draws someone out with a lot of questions, this is very, very polite, a generous way of treating another person. You're not even doing much talking, but they think you're a very good talker, because you're drawing them out. So it's courteous, and it's a good way to start. Secondly, you're going to get information from people in this way. You're going to get an understanding of where they are at. Look, I was sitting on an airplane, this is about a year ago now, next to a young man. He's in his early 30s, a young professional, newly married, and we got into a conversation. I was using my questions in a very casual way, drawing him out, getting to know him a little bit. He noticed that I had a Bible with me. I don't always bring my Bible out on the airplane. I'm not one of these people that always has the Bible in front of me kind of thing. Usually I either want to work or go to sleep when I'm on the airplane, you know. But I just happened to, at that time, be looking at my Bible, and he made a comment about it. We got into a conversation. He asked me what I did for a living. But when I asked him, actually, what in the process of the conversation, he revealed to me that he used to be a Christian. But he wasn't anymore. In fact, he used to be a preacher's kid. Now, how do you used to be a preacher's kid? Because he's still the son of his father, right? Yeah, but his father's no longer a preacher. In fact, his father's no longer a Christian. So here's a former Christian, former preacher's kid, whose dad is no longer in ministry because he's no longer a believer either. Do you think there's any baggage in this person's life? Yeah. Can you imagine if I had jumped in right away with the simple gospel, what he would have thought, how he would have reacted to me? He would have thought, I've been there, I've done that, and it hurt. You know, so I didn't approach it that way, though. We ended up having a nice conversation. In fact, he shared some complaints and some beefs that he had with Christianity. And then towards the end of the conversation, he said, you know what? A lot of guys like you, like the Christian guy, you the religious guy, would be really mad at me right now. But you're not. And then he pressed him. What I was doing was listening. I was gathering information. And in the process of gathering information, I started to get kind of a sense of a spiritual topography. You know what I mean? Like the map of his spiritual life from what he's telling me. I'm getting an awareness of this. I'm getting a picture of it. And now, because now I can see this spiritual topography, I can maneuver around the minefields. And everybody's got them in some sense. If they're a skeptic or an atheist or a non-Christian, they usually have something there that's in the way. And the more that I was able to talk with him and let him talk, and not me talk, the more information I was able to get and the more wisdom I could apply to the circumstance I was facing to choose my words and season them with salt so I knew how to respond to that person. Colossians 4 again. So you can gather information when you're. I'll tell you another thing that's really important about using questions in general, and that is that when you're using questions, you can direct the conversation wherever you want it to go. Now, I'm a talk show host. I've been for 23 years, and I know how to use questions in conversations. And if I'm interviewing somebody, I have a plan for how that interview is going to go. They're doing most of the talking, but they're talking about the things I want them to talk about, and we're telling a story for the audience that is dictated by the questions that I ask. So I'm in charge, even though they're doing the talking. I'm in the driver's seat. And this is the goal of a tactical approach for you. Using your questions to direct the conversation the way that you want it to go. Now, in the Colombo tactic, there are actually three different uses. And each use has a kind of question that we're going to employ. And in fact, the first two uses I'm going to give you a specific question. And our awareness of these three uses actually represents the skeleton of our game plan. So I'm aware of these three things whenever I sit down next to somebody, whenever I consider getting into a conversation. I've got a plan. I've got a way to move forward that I has a good chance of being productive and still allowing the conversation to be comfortable. So here's the first use of Colombo. The first use of Colombo is to gather information. I already made reference to that. Ran out of room there. To gather information. So think of Lieutenant Colombo. He shows up at the crime scene. And how is he going to solve the crime? Well, he can't solve it then because he doesn't know anything except for that there's a body. It's a murder mystery. There's a body. He's got to figure out the circumstances of the death, who was there, what happened, before he can even begin to think about maneuvering through the evidence to try to get to a conclusion. And in the same way, when we encounter someone new, we have to gather some information before we can even think about fulfilling Paul's admonition to season your words with salt, know how to respond to each person, conduct yourself with wisdom, all of that. Okay? So we're going to use questions to gather the information. Now, here's the model question that I want you to consider. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Now, this is a model question. It's very flexible. It can be used in lots of different ways. When the I used it, for example, to start the conversation with the witch in Wisconsin. She was wearing a piece of provocative jewelry. I mean, it was a really big star, so it looked like a statement. She was sending a message, so I decided to ask her regarding her jewelry, what do you mean by that? Now, those weren't the words that I used. I said, does your jewelry have any religious significance? And then she told me, yes, the 5 points stand for earth, wind, fire, water, and spirit. Okay, now I'm locked in. Now I know where this is going. I want to know, well, how is that meaningful to you? So I'm drawing her out and getting information about that specific thing. A lot of times when you're saying, what do you mean by that? You may not even be involved in a spiritual conversation at all, and you're just drawing the person out, getting to know them a little bit, being friendly with them. I understand that, I just found this out yesterday, that Americans seem to be better at that than Europeans. They're more outgoing. But this is still adaptable to Europeans. You can just be a little bit mellower, you know, and talk slower than John, for example, here, and do it in a European fashion, because Europeans are friendly, but they are just friendly in a less friendly way than Americans are friendly, I guess. It's one way of putting it. I think you get the point. You make your adjustments and your adaptations. But we need to take the initiative at some point, though, or it's unlikely anything's going to happen for spiritual good. So the important thing here is the ball's in your court, at least to try to make something happen. So how can we make something happen in the least intrusive way? We can just draw the other person out in a polite fashion, and then we're keeping our ears open and our eyes open for an opportunity to see what the Lord will do. I mentioned, I think, earlier, we get into the batter's box. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if we're going to get a pitch that we can even swing at or whatever. We don't know, but we're going to get ourselves in position to see what God is going to do. And the questions allow you to do that. Now, it might be that someone has already raised some kind of spiritual issue. And I have noticed that there are lots of objections or challenges to Christianity that seem to get a stronger footing than they deserve because of ambiguity or because of lack of clarity in the question or the issue. And for example, I had a student ask me once, who's a Christian, he said, somebody came up to me and said, well, everything's relative. How do I deal with that argument, is what he said to me. And I said, well, first of all, it's not an argument, it's just a point of view. An argument is more than a point of view. An argument has reasons attached to the point of view. So he'd already given it too much credit. But secondly, I said, it is not your job to come up with a response right away to these kinds of things. It is the other person's job to make their points more clear. And if you don't ask them, you're stuck with this, everything's relative, and now what do you do? Maybe you didn't read, well, I wrote a book on relativism, so, you know, maybe you didn't read my book on relativism. Or you don't even, you're caught flat-footed. What, in the statement, everything's relative, what might be a statement that would, I mean, what word might require a little bit more clarification? How about everything? How about relative? How about everything about that sentence requires more, or could use more clarification? What if instead of trying to think about how to answer that challenge, and because the guy who says everything's relative is the person who's trying to put Christianity off. You say Christianity is true, but I'm saying everything's relative. And it's a dismissal. Okay, now what? Well, instead of taking responsibility for taking the next step, maybe we should ask him some questions. And now, what was the first Columbo question to gather information? What was the first question? What do you mean by that? Would that be an okay question to ask somebody who says everything is relative? Absolutely. Now, notice that it's a genuinely inquisitive question. It's not nasty. It's not, what do you mean by that, smart aleck, or something like that. That's not the tone. I want to know what they mean by that. Now, when you ask this question, which is almost always the first question out of my mouth in any kind of engagement, because almost in every case there is some level of ambiguity about what somebody says or maybe a challenge that they make at me, I want to get them talking more. I want them to reveal more so I have more to work with. I do this on the radio. I do this in Q&A sessions at universities. I do it in casual conversations. Tell me more. That's what I'm after. What do you mean by that? Don't be surprised if somebody makes a statement and you say, what do you mean by that? And you get what I call the Simon and Garfunkel response. Now, this is a cultural reference to American songwriters from the 60s. So this is a long time ago. Even some Americans don't remember these guys. But they wrote a song that was very popular called The Sounds of Silence. So sometimes when you ask a person, what do you mean by that? The response you get is The Sounds of Silence. They don't know what they meant by that. They haven't even thought about it. And so when you ask them for more clarification, they don't even know what to say. Now, give them some time. It's their job to do the clarification. It's not your job to do that. And this is one of those situations where when you ask for clarification, remember I said that there are some challenges that get more, they seem to have a stronger footing than they deserve. And you'll find that out when you ask a clarification question. I had a woman say to me, well, all religions are basically the same. This is a waitress at a restaurant in Seattle. And I said, really, in what way are they all basically the same? Now, see, this is just a variation of what do you mean by that? Just asking for more clarification. She was absolutely struck dumb. She stood at the side of the table thinking like this, and finally I started feeling embarrassed for her. And I said, well, maybe like the golden rule or do unto others or something like that. But she had never thought about it. What she had done is she had used this statement to stop Christians. Stonewall them, we say in America. To stop the Christians and to shut them up. Oh, they're all basically the same. But she had never given any thought to whether or not religions were the same. She had just said it. It turns out religions aren't basically the same. They're wildly different. And anybody who studied them knows this. So my first response in any situation is almost always to ask for more information. And it's going to do one of two things, maybe both. It's going to cause that person to think more carefully about what they actually mean. In many cases, when they haven't thought very much about that. And secondly, it's going to then give me more to work with. Maybe what I'm discovering is that person doesn't know what they're talking about. They were really confident 30 seconds ago, and when I asked, what do you mean by that? Or some variation, all of a sudden they realize that the wind has gone out of their sail, and the confidence has gone out of their voice, and I'm not trying to embarrass them. I'm not trying to make them look bad or foolish. Asking the question that they should be able to answer, given their statement that they're not able to answer, shakes them up a little bit. Okay. So, somebody says, I don't believe in God. Now, that might seem pretty straightforward, but it might be good to ask, what do you mean by that? Do you mean that you're agnostic and you have no belief in God one way or another? You're just not sure? Do you mean that you believe that there is no God? It's another possibility. Maybe you don't believe in an old man that's got a white beard and lives in a throne out in space somewhere. Maybe, you know, that's the God you're rejecting. And if that's the God you're rejecting, well, that's the God I reject too, because I don't believe in that kind of God. Maybe you believe not in a personal God of organized religion, but you believe in a God force or something, you know. Maybe you're just a materialist who doesn't believe in any supernatural, any material thing at all. I don't know. And so I can't construct a response unless I get more detail. So by asking the question, what do you mean by that, and inviting them to explain it, I am showing respect for their view. I am trying to understand their view so I don't misrepresent it, and I'm getting more information that helps me to maneuver in the conversation as the conversation continues. By the way, this question, what do you mean by that, is a question you can ask all day long. You don't have to know anything to ask what do you mean. It's a way to get a good education about somebody else's view. I had a person call me on the radio once and said, can you recommend a good book on Buddhism for me? I said, why do you want a book on Buddhism? He said, well, I have a friend who I work with who's a Buddhist, and I'd like to be able to talk with him about Christ. I said, well, don't buy a book on Buddhism. Because first you've got to pay for the book, then you've got to read the book, and chances are it's not going to be the kind of Buddhism he believes in anyway, especially if he's an American. Americans like to pick and choose, you know, and make up their own religion. Americans are a smorgasbord religion, buffet style. I said, better take your money, grab your friend, take him down to the local Starbucks or cafe or whatever, buy him a latte, and ask him. Say, you know, I hear you're a Buddhist. I don't know any Buddhists, but I'm really curious about what Buddhism is. Can you tell me about it? Now, if you were to ask that of your friend, what do you think he'd say? He'd sit back, grab his latte, and tell you all about it. So what you're going to get then is a free education, except for the cost of the coffee, in his Buddhism, and you're going to be learning it in the context of the building a relationship with the person that you want to share Christ with anyway. Now, one thing you don't want to do is after he's talked for 5 minutes about his Buddhism, you don't want to jump in and nail him with your Christianity because he didn't ask you yet. Chances are you'll get around to that. If you do it that way, then he's going to feel maybe ill-abused. Now, listen to him. And then when he tells you different things about it, I'm sure there's a lot of things that won't make sense. Ask more questions. Why would you believe this view? You get all this information from him. And chances are he'll ask you about your own convictions, and then you can move from there. But this is your first move, gathering information by using the Columbo tactic, asking the question, what do you mean by that? Somebody says, well, you shouldn't be forcing your view on me. What's my question? What do you mean by that? How am I forcing my view on you right now? Now, this is a very common challenge to get from people. And I imagine it's probably even folks in Europe are even more sensitive to this because they're more secularized than in the States. But this is a very standard response. It's okay for you to have your view, but when you start acting like your view applies to me, then you've stepped over the line. How am I forcing? My question then is, when he says you shouldn't be forcing your view on me, is how am I forcing my view on you right now? So I want him to explain what it is that I'm doing that's wrong. Now, I'm going to give you a little insight into this problem, and I'm going to give you a way to challenge somebody with questions on it. Okay? This is the kind of issue that you run into when somebody says that you're intolerant. If you believe your religious view is right, or if you believe your moral view is right, like with regards to abortion or homosexuality or something like that, in the States at least, people are very quick to challenge you on that. That's intolerant, all right? So when somebody calls me intolerant, it's happened a number of times, I always want a definition of the word. So I use my first Columbo question. In fact, anytime anybody ever calls you a name, always ask for a definition. If they say you're a racist or a bigot or a homophobe or Islamophobe or whatever it happens to be, or just intolerant, you always ask for a definition. That's our first Columbo question. What do you mean by that? Now, I know what they mean by that. I know what's going on when they're objecting. And what they're objecting to is that I think I'm actually right and correct on a particular issue that it's politically incorrect to act as if you're right and correct about, like religious and moral issues. I think I'm right. And in fact, that's what they'll say. They'll say, well, you think you're right. When I ask them, what do you mean by that? Why are you calling me intolerant? They'll say, well, you think you're right. You think you're right and everybody else is wrong. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think that I think I'm right when I talk about a spiritual or moral conviction? What do you think? Do you think that I think I'm right?
I hope you're not.
Pardon me?
No, no, I hope you're not. You don't think that you're right.
What do you think?
It seems like you wouldn't talk about it if you didn't think you were right.
That's absolutely correct. If I didn't think I was right, I wouldn't believe what I believe. I would believe something else and think that we're right. Just like everybody else. Now, this is the insight I want you to see. In any conversation, when anybody believes anything, they think they're right. That's what it means to believe something. Okay? So I am not the only person in the conversation who thinks they're right. I do think I'm right. Now, I could be mistaken, and I'm willing to talk about that. But he also thinks he's right. That's why he's objecting to me. So when he calls me intolerant because I think I'm right, I have a question for him. And the question is, do you think you're right?
But what do you mean by right?
I mean that my view is the correct one. So if I'm right with regards to God, when I say God exists, I think that he actually does exist. Now, I could be mistaken on that, but that would mean that my view is false. Not that it's true for me. It would be my belief that's a false belief. But I wouldn't believe it to be so if I didn't think it were true. So to fault somebody for believing his beliefs are true is silly, because everybody believes their beliefs are true. The guy who is opposed to me, who is the religious pluralist or whatever, he's objecting to me because I'm not like him. He's got the right view, I got the wrong view. But I'm the only one being called a name, intolerant. So I want him to see this, what's going on. He says, you're intolerant. I ask, what do you mean by that? He said, well, you think you're right. I said, well, yeah, I guess I do. But let me ask you a question. Do you think you're right? What's he going to say? He can't say, no, I think I'm wrong about all my beliefs. Of course he thinks he's right. Now, here's my final question to him. Notice that these are all questions. Why is it when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant? But when you think you're right, you're just right. Well, what am I missing here? Now, of course, I'm not missing anything. I know what's going on. What he has done is he's shifted the discussion from whatever it is we were talking about, homosexuality, same-sex marriage, abortion, Jesus, God, whatever it happens to be, he shifted the discussion from the issue to me, to my personality. So instead of dealing with the issue, now he's attacking me. I say something is true about Jesus. He says, you have bad character. You're intolerant. Well, now he's not talking about the same thing anymore, is he? He's avoiding the issue. By the way, could it be that I'm actually really a nasty guy? Sure. But that doesn't have any bearing on whether Jesus is who he claims to be or whether this moral issue is what it is. This is a distraction. What if I said to him, when he calls me intolerant, I say, well, and you're ugly? Now, I wouldn't say that, but you can see immediately how that would be inappropriate, because whether or not the person is ugly has nothing to do with whether or not the issue that we're talking about is true or false. But how is that different from what he's just done to me? If I call him ugly, I'm attacking his looks. He calls me intolerant. He's attacking my character. Now we're talking about each other. We're not talking about the issue. So my series of questions here is to help him to see that what he has just done is he's changed the topic into something that is not very doing something that's not attractive. You're just attacking me personally. You're calling me names. You're not dealing with the issue. Maybe I am intolerant. Maybe I have all kinds of vices. I actually said this in a TV show, a national TV show in Canada, where I was attacked because the issue was religious pluralism. And I had given a straightforward argument against religious pluralism, an argument that does not trade on my own religious convictions. I said, anybody can use this argument, no matter what you believe, to show that it's not true that all religions are true. It may be that all religions are false, but they can't all be equally true. Maybe mine's a false one, I don't know, but they can't all be true. That was my argument. I didn't give you the argument proper just now, but I made the argument. And then pretty soon they started, you know, I'm the intolerant, narrow-minded one because I'm a Christian. I never laid my Christianity out there. That wasn't why I was there. I was there to talk about pluralism, not Christianity. But they started attacking me. And I said, you know, it's interesting what's happened. We started out talking about an idea, pluralism, and somehow we've gotten distracted onto another topic. And the other topic is Mr. Kokel's personality. Mr. Kokel's narrow-minded. Mr. Kokel's intolerant. I guess you mean that I'm just mean. I said, all right, maybe I am. How about if I just admit that I'm mean? I said this on the air. The panel, there were three other people there. A Sikh, a Hindu, and a very liberal woman pastor from the United Church of Canada. And I said, well, how about if I just admit that I'm mean? And so then I agree with you on all that. Now, can we just set that aside then and get back to talking about what we're supposed to be talking about here? Which is pluralism. And so it was an attempt to show what was going on, that this is just the wrong way to approach it. Incidentally, in the States at least, this is the number one technique for dealing with ideas that people do not like. It is to redirect the attack on the individual rather than address the issue. Now, this is a common fallacy. It's called the ad hominem. You attack the individual rather than address the issue. But it's bad thinking. We shouldn't do this to other people, but if they do it to us, we should challenge it, but we challenge it with questions.
It's the same here.
Pardon me?
It's the same here.
Same here in Europe, yeah. It's amazing to me how intelligent people think that this is a reasonable way of dealing with issues. Okay? Now, we're just about to take a break, so let me just recap where we've come so far. We've been talking about an approach to engaging people and finding a way to get into conversations that is smooth and comfortable but productive. How to take the stuff that we've learned in other sessions at conferences like this and create a setting that allows us to integrate those things as we're able to. Now, we haven't got to that stage yet. We've just got to the initial stage. How do we get involved in conversations? And I'm suggesting there's a game plan that involves using questions. I call it the Columbo tactic. In very particular ways to help gather what we've talked about so far is first to gather information. Now, after our 20-minute break, we'll come back and we'll talk about the other two uses of Columbo. And how these can be useful to you in conversations with other people. Questions?
I think that it's a
no. This is a fair question. The question for the tape then. Do I really think that intelligent people think ad hominems are legitimate ways of responding? And my candid response is yes, I think they do. It is not an intelligent thing to do, but they don't think about responding intelligently most of the time. Later on, tomorrow, I think, I'm giving a talk called Bad Arguments Against Religion. And the point that I make at the beginning is very, very smart people, intelligent people, PhDs, lawyers, doctors, academics of all sorts, make very foolish mistakes in thinking when it comes to spiritual things, and they don't see it. I was talking to William Lane Craig yesterday, who I guess he's one of the speakers here, and just a phenomenal debater. He debates the smartest guys in the world. And it is unbelievable how lame the cases that are offered by the smartest guys in the world against William Lane Craig in debates. And they seem to be satisfied with this kind of thing, even though it can be pointed out quantifiably that they're making a blunder of reasoning. When it's pointed out, sometimes they'll, you know, pause and say, well, maybe you got a point there. But they don't see it initially. They do this all the time. About a month and a half ago, they had a big rally in Washington, D.C. They called it the Reason Rally. All the atheists showed up, 200,000 of them, you know, to make a show of force. We're the smart guys. So Richard Dawkins was there on the Mall giving an address, and here's what he told the atheists to do with regards to religious people. He says you should mock them and show contempt for them and make fun of them. Do you think I could ever get away with addressing a group like this and saying, let me teach you how to deal with atheists? You make fun of them? You wouldn't even buy that. These are the guys that are at the Reason Rally. And this is the advice that the head honcho, Richard Dawkins, is giving to his people? It doesn't occur to him, apparently, that this is an illicit way of arguing. And if they had good points to make, they could make it better than just by making fun of people. But it seems to pass as a legitimate way of form of discourse for them. Incidentally, I think the reason that Richard Dawkins offered this advice to his sheep is because the shepherd practices that. Dawkins does this, and so he's telling them to do it as well. To those of us who know better, we look at that and say, well, it's just ad hominem. How could you even, why aren't you embarrassed? But they do it. And I am convinced that they have fooled themselves in many cases into thinking that this is a legitimate way of addressing the issue. I'd like to think better of them, but I don't. I would really like to think better of them, but I don't. I've seen it too often. I've seen Michael Shermer, the American atheist who I debated for 3 hours on national radio, and who's the author of Skeptic, who's the editor of Skeptic magazine, and he continues along with a lot of these guys who push back against the ID, intelligent design movement. He continues to ask, okay, who created God? Now, this is a question that Richard Dawkins says even children know how to ask. He says in his book, The Grand Delusion. Well, of course children ask this question because they don't know any better. That God is an uncreated being by definition. Whether he exists or not is a different issue, but that's not a question that any theist has to answer. And he brings this up every single time in his debates. I knew it was coming, and so I was prepared. And when he brought it up on the radio debate, I said, Richard, you don't believe God was created because you don't, I mean, not Richard, but Michael, you don't believe God was created because you don't believe in God. I don't believe God was created because I think God is an eternal being. There's nobody in this discussion who believes God was created. So why are you asking who created God? I almost said he knows better. He ought to know better. Because he's been challenged on this time and time and time again. That there is nothing in our view, nothing about any cosmological argument, no way that we argue that requires that God be created. But they continue to ask this question as if they've never heard the answer before. And I don't know what to make of that. It's either intellectual dishonesty. It's not stupidity, because these men aren't stupid. It's either intellectual dishonesty or utter blindness. And I'm not entirely sure which one's which in every situation. But I'd like to think better of them. I just don't. I just do not respect these people. I don't respect them as thinkers. Let's put it that way. I respect them as human beings. It's amazing, though. Any other questions before we break? We have a little bit more than 2 hours to go, and what I'd like to do is use that time to finish out kind of the game plan and maybe offer at least one other tactic that is a defensive tactic that you may need. What I've described so far is a certain approach to engaging people that I call the tactical approach that is built on a single tactic called the Columbo tactic, which is using questions in a very deliberate fashion. And we talked about the first way we use the Columbo tactic, and that's to gather information. And our first question is, what do you mean by that? And it's a question that can be asked all the time in very different ways. And to to help you understand the other person, to gather information. I want to talk about the other two uses of Columbo, and then maybe to close things off, talk about an additional tactic called the steamroller tactic, which is something you should be prepared to use when somebody else is too aggressive with you. This is very important, when they're a steamroller to you. The other tactics in the book, suicide and taking the roof off, and just the facts, ma'am, and Rhodes Scholar and those things, are used in conjunction with the third use of Columbo, and I'll explain that in a few moments. Okay, so we talked about Columbo is a question-asking tactic by which we gather information, first off, and we use the question, what do you mean by that, as a way of doing that. The second use of Columbo, and here I'm going to call this reversing the burden of proof. Whoops. Reversing the burden of proof. Now, what do I mean by burden of proof? You heard this phrase before, burden of proof? What does this phrase mean? Someone help me? Innocent until proven guilty. That's kind of a way of expressing how burden of proof is applied in criminal cases in the States. It doesn't tell me what burden of proof means. It means the burden of proof is on the one who's accusing, yeah. But what is burden of
proof? Is it when person has to, when you have to find some proofs for your way of thinking?
Yes, exactly. Burden of proof is the responsibility, that's the burden, the responsibility to give evidence, mm-hmm. Okay? So here's a question. Given that burden of proof means the responsibility to give evidence, in any conversation between two people on some controversial topic, who has the burden of proof? Who has the responsibility?
Whoever's making a claim.
Mm-hmm. Who's ever making the claim? You mentioned about American jurisprudence, innocent until proven guilty. If a person is accusing someone else of the crime, they are making the claim that some person committed a crime. It is their job then to shoulder the burden to prove that the person had committed the crime. So whoever makes the claim bears the burden of proof. Okay, now this is a very important concept, and I'll tell you why. Because for far too long, Christians who have been involved in conversations with skeptical people about Christianity have taken all of the responsibility upon themselves to make the case, when the skeptic can say whatever he wants and then just sit back and fold his arms and then expect that the Christian is going to do all the work, all the heavy lifting. They get a free ride. And so this principle here of reversing the burden of proof basically is a notice that the skeptic doesn't get a free ride. That yes, if the Christian is going to make a claim, Jesus rose from the dead, God exists, or whatever it happens to be, the Bible's the word of God, well then it really is our job to give some reasons why we think this is really true. But if the other side makes a claim, if the person says God does not exist, or that Jesus is just a bunch of fables, or the Bible was changed and retranslated and whatever, then it's their job to support their own view. And so the principle of reversing the burden of proof is just a simple principle of requiring the person who makes the claim against us to defend the claim, instead of us taking the responsibility to refute the claim. It's their job to defend their claim first. Okay, let me tell you what happened in a radio interview that I had in Los Angeles, a very big secular station there in Los Angeles, KFI. More stimulating talk radio, they say, because it's the place where all the radical talk show hosts are on, you know, the leftist radical guys, you know, they're the crazies. And so I was asked to come on a show and to talk about intelligent design creation. And so I did my opening comments, and then they opened the lines and people call in. And there was a caller who started challenging my view based on Big Bang cosmology. So he says, there's this Big Bang, and so you're wrong about God. I said, wait a minute, that isn't the way it works. Big Bang works for me, not against me. Now, I know that some Christians are, this is controversial in some Christian circles, but I actually think if there was a Big Bang, that's evidence for God. Because as I like to put it, a Big Bang needs a Big Banger, you know. Somebody's got to pull a trigger. Incidentally, if you've heard Dr. Craig's presentation on the Kalam cosmological argument, which is fabulous, and he's done a great job in developing this argument, that's his argument in one sentence. If you didn't understand William Lane Craig's Kalam cosmological argument, here's all you got to know. A Big Bang needs a Big Banger. That's it. That's down-to-earth, blue jeans, apologetics, right? Working class stuff. Simple. Somebody had to pull the trigger, you know? You hear a Big Bang. You're sitting here and all of a sudden, boom! You think, what was that? You don't mean what was it, because you know what it was. It was a Big Bang. What you mean is what caused it, because you know a Big Bang needs a Big Banger. What caused the bang? And if the universe banged into existence, there had to be some cause prior to the universe to cause it. Anyway, so this is the point that I'm making with this guy. So this guy says, no. You don't need a Big Banger to get a Big Bang. And I'm going to explain to you how. So I'm all ears, you know. I want to hear what he has to say. By the way, is that an Americanism too? I think I'm using American. I'm all ears. That means I'm listening. If you're not familiar with that, it must sound like really strange. I am all ears. What the heck does that mean? Well, you get the picture.
We're still swinging for the fences.
Yeah, we're still swinging. When I was in Italy a couple of months ago, I really had a strong realization of how much of my communication trades on these, not slang, but just
pictures.
Americanisms. I don't know. So I hope you're following me. It seems you're grinning at the right time, so this is a good sign. And your English must be very good because I'm talking rather quickly, but you're still following. Anyway, here's what he said. I wrote it down because I recorded the session. He said this. Well, I don't think it is. I don't think a Big Bang needs a Big Banger. It's a good argument. Because, so now he's going to give me his explanation. So I'm listening, all ears. You could start with a base of nothing, and you could say that there was nothing but an infinite continuous moment. And then, eventually, one tiny little insignificant thing happened. A point happened in the nothingness. Well, of course, that's the problem, isn't it? How do you get a point in the nothingness? But maybe it's a really small point, so it's easy. I don't know, but he just asserts this. He just says it. A point happened in the nothing, and then the point expanded. Curious. Which is extremely simple, he said, because it requires no intelligence, so no intelligent God had to intervene. You could take that, it requires no intelligence in two different ways, I guess, couldn't you? All we need... And the nice thing about radio is they can't see you kind of going, oh, my gosh, like that. Can't see your face. But I wasn't saying anything because I don't want to be rude. It requires no intelligence, so no intelligent God had to intervene. All we need is a little tiny imperfection in the perfect nothingness. And that imperfection expanded and became variegated variety and increasingly complex. And soon you had galaxies and planets kind of spinning out of this. Now, apparently, here's the way he sees it. He said, first you start with nothing, and nothing is like a pond, a placid, calm pond, nothing. And then you get a little speck of something from somewhere. He didn't say where that came from. It's just a little something that kind of lands in the nothing. And when it hits the nothing gets really annoyed. And then it starts bucking and weaving and starts spitting out universes, planets, solar systems, the like. So I get to answer this guy, right? So what am I going to say? How do you answer that? Well, here's what I said. I said, it's interesting the way you started your explanation. You said you could say that. And then you told us a fairy tale. And I said, you're right. You can say anything you want. But giving us reasons to take it seriously, that's another thing entirely, and that's your job. It's not my job to refute this. It is his job to make sense of it. And see, this is the key of reversing the burden of proof. Skeptics can spin all kinds of stories, and they're happy to do it. And a lot of times their stories will start this way. Oh, I can explain that. Oh, I can explain that. And then they give an alternate explanation to our view. Oh, the Bible? Oh, the Bible's got all these miracles in it. Yeah, well, I can explain that. You see, what happened is the early church, wanting to gain power, rewrote the stories about the man Jesus into the God-man Jesus and gave him miraculous powers, and then he gave authority to the church, and so now the church can control all the people. If you read the Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, this was the basic thesis of Dan Brown. And this idea of Jesus the God-man was invented in the 3rd century. So that explains it. Well, it does explain it as far as it goes. That is, it is an explanation. But he hasn't given us any reason to believe that his explanation is the accurate explanation. And that's the step that needs to be told. So he might tell us all of this, the Dan Brown story or whatever, and I might ask more questions, what do you mean by that, to gather information to get clear on what he thinks took place that explains how the miracles got in the Bible. But he's got to do more than that. He can't just give me a story that he made up. He's got to give me reasons why he thinks that's the true story of how the Bible came about, rather than the story that I'm telling. And I'm willing to give reasons and evidence that the documents are historically reliable as written. That's a separate issue. He doesn't nullify my evidence by just telling a different story. This is what they complain about Christians doing all the time, just telling stories and believing a story. You know, when the Da Vinci Code came out, I gave talks about it, to respond publicly. And I'd have people call me or they'd come up to me and tell me, yeah, I got lots of friends at school and they tell me they believe the Dan Brown story. And I said, you should ask him this question. Why do you believe that? Because you read it in a book? Isn't that what you're complaining about us believing? Dan Brown's book is in the fiction section of the bookstore for a reason. It's a fiction. Why would you believe that this is actually... Well, because Dan Brown says in the beginning, it says all of these things are based on fact. But that's part of the fiction. That's quantifiably false, that statement that he makes in the beginning. In any event, using the second part, or the second use of the Columbo tactic, questions, we use it to reverse the burden of proof, that is, force people to give evidence when they make the claim. And the question that we use, the model question is, okay, now, how did you come to that conclusion? How did you come to that conclusion? Or what are your reasons for that? Or why would you think that's the way it really happened? Or something along that line. The point is, we do not give them a free ride. We don't let them say whatever they want, and now it's our job to try to figure out how to refute it. Rather, it's their job to give evidence first. Even if you have good reasons against the view, I'm suggesting that for tactical advantage, you throw the question into their court. You let them do the heavy lifting on their own claims, rather than make them force you to refute them. Just because they give another alternate explanation doesn't mean they've refuted your view. They've just got a new point of view. And I'll get to your question in just a second. I just want to give you another image. There's a phrase in English that comes from the medieval times. And it's the phrase is, you throw the gauntlet into the arena. You know what a gauntlet is? Gauntlet is a glove, okay? I'm impressed. You know what that means. A lot of Americans don't know what that means. It's a glove that the knights used to wear. Now, when a knight would throw his glove down into the arena, What did this mean? What did it signify?
Challenge.
A challenge. Okay, so this is their way of, like if you're a card player, you ante up, you know, in poker, you put your chips in or whatever. You're in play, okay? But the knight doesn't throw his glove into the arena and then say, okay, I win. No, you just joined. Now you've got to put up or shut up. Now you've got to fight and show what you got. And the same thing is true in these kinds of discussions. And I don't mean fight literally. I don't mean a nasty argument. I'm saying, look, if you've got a contrary idea, okay, you got to play fair and by the rules. You can't just throw your idea into the arena and then walk away and act like you win just because you opened your mouth. But this happens all the time. And so what we're going to do is we're going to keep the person who makes the alternate claim honest. And we're going to keep them honest by asking them a question. We're going to reverse the burden of proof by asking them the question, okay, now how did you come to that conclusion? And incidentally, when you ask the question, now how did you come to that conclusion, you are making an assumption. And it's a charitable or generous assumption. What is the assumption you're making when you ask the question, now how did you come to that conclusion? What's the
They
thought it through. And they came to a conclusion. Don't count on it. It's amazing how often you ask somebody, now how did you come to that conclusion or something like it? And they'll... Sounds of silence again. Nothing. I've had some people say to me, honest to goodness, they say, I don't have any reasons for believing that. You don't have any reason. So I have another question now. Why would you believe something without having any reasons to believe it? I don't have a reason for that either. You know, it's just amazing. What this shows is a lot of times that the people who are really the smart people, who have the strong attitudes and all that other stuff, when you ask just a couple of questions, and by the way, we've not done anything so far except for asked two questions. What do you mean by that? How'd you come to that conclusion? We haven't made our case at all. And a lot of times just those two questions are enough to reduce that person to kind of a silence because they don't know what to do with it because they haven't thought about it. Yes, sir. Robert.
Just a quick question. I was on staff with Campus Crusade, came to know the Lord through Campus Crusade and my universities, but I've been in Hungary now for 12 years. Is there a tendency of moving away from a Josh McDowell type of an evidentialist approach where I remember being in Crusade, everybody was learning how to answer questions and to more of an offensive approach, where as opposed to focusing so much on defending the faith and establishing my reasons, but much more being bold and aggressive, kind of learning what we need to learn. Of course, that's important, but taking much more of an offensive, saying, I don't need to have every answer to every question. I just need to be asking what they believe.
Yeah.
There's been a shift in the
last... Let me repeat the question for the recording. The question is, has there been a shift in apologetics from in the past being kind of defensive position, kind of a Josh McDowell defending the faith approach where evidence that demands a verdict kind of thing, and we are in a defensive posture based on challenges, to being more aggressive or more offensive in the sense of being aggressive, taking the initiative and demanding of others a characterization? And I don't, there is a, my answer would be that I think there is a new richness and vigor broadly in the apologetics arena, and a confidence of informed Christians that allows them to be more aggressive in challenging the other side. It certainly is a part of my approach. I don't know if that's much different than it was 30 or 40 years ago. Because I know Francis Schaeffer, during the same period that Josh was really well known. In fact, there were only a handful of people back then. Francis Schaeffer, Josh, Walter Martin, Norm Geisler was around then, and so was John Montgomery. And that was about it, five guys. This is I call them the first column in the fight. And what Schaeffer was doing the challenge on a presuppositional basis. You know, okay, where does your worldview lead if you follow it? You know, so I think some of that was going on. I don't know if there's as much a shift in emphasis as there just is a more of a robustness to the entire enterprise that we have now. It's a fabulous thing that I think is going on now. And I think that we have, it is appropriate for us to press the other side aggressively. It's a part of my own approach. Even though, you know, I'm Mr. Colombo and ask the questions, as you'll see in the third use of Colombo, they can be used in a very aggressive way. When I deal with the problem of evil and I address a secular audience, I tell them that I am not addressing the problem of evil as a philosopher or as a theologian or apologist. I first approach it as a human being who has to make sense out of my world. That's true for every human being. The problem of evil is a problem for everybody. It's not just a problem for me. And if you are an atheist because of the problem of evil, you have not escaped the problem. You have just eliminated one possible answer. That is theism. You are still strapped with the problem because your first complaint was, how can there be a God since there is so much evil in the world? Well, if you've gotten rid of God, you still have the evil in the world. Now what? Do you see the problem here? And so my approach then is to ask, is to tell the secularist, I am going to do my best to make to deal with some of the issues here, but ultimately what it's going to come down to is a battle of worldviews. Which worldview has the best resources to deal with this problem? And the, and I'll make this point tomorrow in my talk on bad arguments against religion. The atheist worldview doesn't even have the resources to raise the issue. It can't even make sense of the problem of evil to begin with on the resources it's left with. So it's my opinion that the problem of evil is a great argument for the existence of God, not against. But notice my style here is to be aggressive with that and say, you've got something to answer for as well. So certainly in my own life, I'm much more aggressive in that particular regard. And and maybe this is a sign of the times, and of our times in a good way, of the apologetics enterprise, because we can be, I think we are justified in being more aggressive with people, intellectually aggressive. What do you have to offer? You tell me. You're the secularist. You're the materialist. You're the guy who doesn't believe in anything you can't see. So you tell me. You're the one complaining about the problem of evil. You tell me. How do you make sense of that in your worldview? They can't. There is a real problem. They know that. We're the only ones who can even make sense of the question. And this plays powerfully in our direction. If you want to see, hear me develop that, I'll be giving a talk tomorrow right after lunch. Called Bad Arguments Against Religion, and that's one of the bad arguments. So if you'd like to attend that, welcome to it. Yes, question?
This story how the creation began without the creator has a sense because that you gave the person you met. Because we do see things like this in the contemporary physics. We see small perturbation and then a non-linear effect which grows. So I think this person indeed has a reason to believe something like this.
He has a reason to believe that the beginning of the universe
it can be just a small perturbation in the nothing and then
okay, let me just respond to this though, because the question has to do with It there's a certain understandableness. A small perturbation in the nothing could create the universe. So the response is understandable. There's a very fundamental mistake that's being made here, and it happens all the time. And it happened with this person here. And the mistake is to treat nothing as if it were something. There can't be a perturbation in nothing because there's nothing to perturb. Nothing is no thing. There is no ontological status. There is no thing there. Nothing isn't like a placid pond. It isn't like an empty space. It isn't even a space. It's completely, it's not even right to call it inert because only things are inert. Nothing is nothing. Lack of ontology. I don't know. Bill Craig has a good way of putting it, you know, but I can't remember how he said it. It's just, and so the tendency is so frequently to treat nothing as if it were something. Even physicists nowadays, and Bill's talking about the Cambridge mathematician, Stephen Hawking. In one of his talks coming up this week and assessing his book, and even Hawking and the whole raft of them treat, when they say nothing, they don't mean nothing in the philosophical sense of nothing. But indeed, all of their models require that there was philosophically nothing. There was nothing in the philosophical sense, non-existence, and then things existed. So, strictly speaking, everything would have to come from nothing, and the nothing that it would have to come from was not anything that could be perturbed. You know, notice that even in the explanation here, he says he's got this. He start with an infinite continuous moment, which you wouldn't even have a moment in nothingness. Then you have a tiny insignificant point happens in the nothingness, and this is, and the point expanded. Of course, this is the problem. Where does this point? The point that drops into the nothingness that perturbs it, where does this point even come from? Oh, he just magically produced it. And this is worse than, it's worse than magic. Because in magic, you pull a rabbit out of a hat. A magician pulls a rabbit out of a hat, right? But in this case, there's no hat. And there's no magician. There's just a rabbit, like this. Now, let me just tell you a little story since we did this illustration, and I'll get back to the details here. Because you may find this handy and useful for you in the future, but it has to do with that dinner party that I was at where the young man announced he was an atheist, because we got in a discussion about a Big Bang needed a Big Banger. And he was very belligerent and not really interested in any meaningful discussion whatsoever. He was just utterly dismissive. No, it doesn't make any sense. He didn't want to hear about it. But I did get to make a point. And the point was, I said, because he didn't take exception with the Big Bang. I said, look, if somebody were to knock on the door right over there, because we were in the dining room in the front of the house, front door was there, what would you do? Would you think that the knock knocked itself? Or would you get up and answer the door because you would presume that something or someone caused the effect? Something adequate to the effect would cause it. No, he was just completely dismissive. But here's the way the story ends, the rest of the story. After we were done talking, we're having dessert, and I promise, as God is my witness, on the front door. Who knocks on front doors anymore? I mean, in the States, everybody's got a doorbell. Ding dong, you know, you don't knock on the door. Somebody's knocking on the door. He's sitting across from me, and he looks up from his table, and he goes, "Who's that?" Because we were all surprised to hear it. And I said, "No one." And here's the important part. What did he do? He got up, and he answered the door, which is meant to show that even in something as simple as a door knock, no one in his right mind would presume that the knock knocked itself.
Is anybody there?
Turned out to be one of his friends. So, by the same token, when I make my case for theism, I'm asking the question, what view makes the most sense? What is the most reasonable view? It might be that somebody can talk themselves into the idea that knocks can knock themselves and universes can just pop into existence out of nothing. You might be able to talk yourself into that, but is it the odds-on favorite? Is it the most reasonable possibility? Keep in mind, there's a lot at stake here. And the secularists are the ones that are calling us the idiots. We're the fools. We're the crazy people. We're the ones who make these wild leaps of faith, and they believe that the knock knocks itself. And the Big Bang banged itself, because that's all they've got. Incidentally, along this line of clarification, I want to give you another illustration. The book is filled with all kinds of illustrations of these points here, real-life illustrations for me. But I had once a person that was asked me in a Q&A session. He said, prove to me, it wasn't a question, it was a request. Prove to me God exists. I'm the guy. I'm the apologist. I'm in front of the whole audience. And here he gives me this question. So I'm on the spot, right? Well, part of the problem was, and this is what I pointed out, I said, is the question as it's put to me is not a question I'd ever be willing to engage. Because there are two things wrong with the question. Now, let me just ask you as a class. I want you to just reflect on this. The guy says, again, not a question request, but there's two things wrong with it. Prove to me God exists. What might be one of two things that's problematic for me to respond to that? Never mind whether I can give evidence for God's existence. Let's just assume I've got these evidences, which I do, that I could bring to the table. What is the problem? A problem with the way the question is asked. Problem for me. He's got a rhetorical advantage already. Say that again, I'm sorry.
By the fact that you would answer to his request, you would accept the presumption of God.
Possibility, yeah. Well, I'm not troubled with the theoretical possibility that God doesn't exist. That isn't what is problematic for me in this kind of challenge. And it's good. This is a good exercise because you, part of what you need to be thinking about is how challenges are put to you and how you can fix the problem with the right kind of clarifications or questions before you respond with an answer. Robert?
Maybe you could ask, Ben, when will you be satisfied? Like, what level of proof do I need to reach for you to be satisfied with my answer?
Yeah, see, this is part of the problem. And the word proof, what does he mean by the word proof? Notice our first Columbo question, which is what I asked him. I said, I need to know what you think is adequate proof before I can give it to you. Because if he doesn't clarify for me what counts as proof, he can always say, no matter what I offer, that I haven't proved it. Right? Okay, but there's another thing, you hinted on it. It's very similar. It's close to it. Maybe I'll just tell you. Well, go ahead.
It's probably not what you're thinking, but I want to know which God he wants proved.
Oh, okay. He wants proved the God that I'm advancing.
Yeah, but okay. I think that's a really important question. The Old Testament considers that an essential question,
yeah.
And we miss that question all the time,
yeah,
in apologetics.
Yeah.
We say God, and we assume everybody knows which God we're talking,
yeah,
about.
Yeah, okay.
So I want to know which,
okay,
God he wants me to prove.
Okay. Paul.
Is there the alternative question, why should I be asked the question of prove this, and you not the question of prove not this?
Well, in this particular case, it's a Q&A session, and I'm supposed to be the guy who's answering the challenges. You know, whether he has a burden of proof to show that God doesn't exist is a valid question, but it's a separate issue. Let me just tell you what the other problem was, and you really touched on it, Robert, a little bit. You hinted at it. Not only is the word proof ambiguous, but when he says to me, that means give me some kind of legitimate evidence, whatever that means, I don't know yet, that is adequate to convince me. I don't know if what's going to be adequate to convince him. If I have to shoulder that responsibility, I can never meet it. Because he can always say as well, it's not proof to me. I'm not convinced. So it's not even valid. And so I said, I want you to rephrase your question so that I am not saddled with those liabilities. I don't have that problem to deal with. And so he said, all right, can you give me, how did he put it, a viable reason to believe, not for me to believe, but to believe that God exists. I said, that I can do. And then I asked him a series of questions. And in fact, this might be, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but let me just play this out, and then I'll go backwards since I'm in the flow. There's a third use of Columbo. There's going to be a problem with then I want to talk about it reversing the burden proof. But let's just jump into the third use of Columbo. And in the book, I call this leading, for lack of a better phrase. But I just thought of another phrase that really is much better than this, and I wish I would have thought of it before I published the book a few years ago. But you use questions to make a point. I don't even know, your notes might say something else, but you can use questions to gather information. What do you mean by that? You can use questions to reverse the burden of proof. Now, how did you come to that conclusion? But there are times when you're going to use questions to make a point. Now, notice in the first two uses of Columbo, you don't need to know anything. So if you're a rank beginner, you can engage and manage conversations simply by asking those two questions. You can maneuver effortlessly in those conversations just by drawing people out. Never taking a stand yourself, just getting an education. That's fine. That's progress, okay? But if you want to go a step further and you want to make a point, you got to know something. You got to know the point you want to make, for example. You want to know how you're going to use your questions to hit a target. So think of it like archery, where your questions are like the arrows, and the point you want to make is the target you're shooting your arrows at. Now, it might be that you're trying to explain your own point of view, and I'll give you some illustrations of that in just a moment. It might be that you want to show a weakness or a flaw in somebody else's view, but you do it by using a question. So I was just given the illustration of the gentleman who said, prove to me that God exists. And then I got him to modify it. Because basically I'm saying to him, that's stacked against me, the way this question is asked. So that's not a fair way of putting it to me. Now, I wasn't accusing him of being improper. He just wasn't thinking about what he was asking. And by the way, this happens all the time, by the way. People will make these kinds of challenges that turn out to be unfairly balanced towards their side, favoring their side. And so it's okay to negotiate a little bit. That's a problem for me. I don't know what proof means to you, and I don't know what's going to satisfy you. So let's put it different. Oh, you want a valid reason. Okay, I can give you that. Okay, let me ask you a few questions. So now what I'm going to do here, the rest of this little talk with him that I'll share with you, I'm using Columbo number 3. I know what I want to do. I know the point that I want to make, but I want to have him participate with me in conversation. Instead of just preaching at him, I'm going to ask him some questions. So I said, do you think, some of these are going to be simple, actually, I said, but bear with me. Do you think things exist? Yes, of course. Oh, good. Well, some people are even skeptical on that, you know. It's like Rabbi Zacharias answered, the guy said, what about a person who doesn't believe he exists? How do you respond? And the rabbi says, you ask him who's asking the question. So there's a self-evident nature to some of this, you know. I said, okay, great. Now, of those things that exist here, the physical world, did they always exist? Is the physical world eternal? He says, no. Big Bang cosmology, basically. The universe came into being at some point in the distant past. How long past is a matter of debate, but it's not important to my point. So I've already asked two questions. I've got two acknowledgments by him. Third question. What caused the universe to come into existence? Well, I don't know, he says. And I said, well, it's actually not that complicated. You have one of two choices. Something or nothing. Something or nothing. So what do you think? Now, notice what I've done is I've asked questions in a very particular way to limit the options. If you're thinking in terms of rational principles, it's the law of excluded middle, either A or not A, either something or not something. There's only two options there. The problem for him is that there's only one option that makes any sense. Because if he says nothing caused the universe to come into existence, that's worse than magic, like I said. But if he says something caused it, which is the reasonable response, then that something has got to be something outside of the natural universe, because the natural universe is the effect. it's going to have to be something powerful enough to cause the natural universe. It's probably going to have to be something personal, right, to be able to bring this particular universe into existence. Now, outside of time, outside of space, gee, you know, that's starting to sound pretty much like the God I have in mind, to answer your question, to me. Notice with just a couple of questions, I have pushed him to a point of having to either acknowledge that something very close to my understanding of God exists as a cause for the universe, or saying something foolish, that the universe came from nothing. That's the only two choices. And I got there very quickly, once I set up the game rules, by asking a couple of very simple questions. It wasn't hard. So there's an example of using questions to make a point. Sometimes you are trying to show a liability or a flaw in somebody's view. You know there's a problem. Instead of pointing the problem out, you'll use questions. So I was at a chiropractor, a doctor's office, and he was the physical therapist was working in my back over a series of weeks, and so I got to know him a little bit, and we were talking about spiritual things a number of occasions, and the issue of homosexuality came up, and he was troubled by my own point of view, which I think that homosexuals are human beings made in the image of God and deserve respect in that regard, but their behavior is wrong. He says, the problem with you Christians is that you may be nice people, but before long you start getting judgmental. Okay. Now, he had just made a mistake. He didn't see it. He didn't know it. But I saw it right away because I'm looking for these things, and so I'm going to try to exploit it. I said to him, what's wrong with that? His name is Glenn, I think. Anyway, I said, what's wrong with that? And he says, it's wrong to judge. Okay, now some of you are chuckling because you realize what just happened. What did he just do? He made a judgment. He made a judgment while he's saying it's wrong to judge. So now I saw this. Now, I could have said, oh, you're doing the same thing you're telling me not to do. That's a contradiction. Okay, well, that's true. But it wouldn't be a very elegant way of making my point, would it? Or effective. It would just be a charge on him. Instead, I said, he said, well, you're judging me. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? And he said, well, judging is wrong. And I said, well, if judging is wrong, then why are you judging me right now? That's all I asked him. Well, he had never heard anything like that before. And I caught him completely off guard. And he just stepped back a little bit, and he starts to think, and he's trying to regroup. And he's thinking about it. And I could hear him. No, that's not good. He's trying to figure. Finally, he comes back to me, and he says, I guess I was judging. Can't avoid it. Maybe judging isn't wrong. Guess it's okay to judge. But, he said, no, he wasn't going to let me off that easily. He said, but you can't push your morality on other people. That's where you cross the line. So now he think he'd improved his situation, had he? No, he'd just done the same thing in a different way. Because I had another what for him? Another question. The question was, Gil, that's his name, Gil, is that your morality? When you say it's wrong to push your morality on someone else, is that your moral point of view? He said, yes. I mean, he didn't even see it coming. I said, well, then why are you pushing your morality on me right now? Oh, yeah, wow, that's right, you know. And he's back rubbing his chin again. And finally he made a couple of false starts, and he couldn't get going, obviously. And then he gets real frustrated. He says, God, it's not fair. I said, what do you mean it's not fair? He said, I can't find a way to say it in which it sounds right. I said, Gil, he thought it was a word trick, you know. I said, it's not a trick. You're doing the very thing you're telling me not to do. This is an example of the suicide tactic, by the way, which is later in the book, when you find out somebody has a self-refuting view. But I'm using Columbo now to exploit it, to show the problem. And sometimes when I get to this point, people will tell me, well, now you got me all confused. And I say, no, you were confused when you started. So, but notice I try to be very friendly with them and everything. I just want them to see this isn't going to work. You know, maybe you got some other things that are going to work, but this isn't going to work. So what else you got? What am I doing? I see a weakness or a flaw, and this is something you'll see more. The more that you learn at conferences like this, the more of these problems you're going to see. So how do you make a bridge? You think, what's the question I can ask, or the series of questions that I can ask, to take this piece of information that I've learned at the conference and apply it in this circumstance where I know it will do some good. How can I do that in a tactically efficient fashion? What questions? We'll talk about how you maybe become better at doing that, but I want you to get the concept here, that you're using this to make a point. Sometimes you're going to make a point about something you know, but you want them to discover. When I wrote the book on relativism with Dr. Frank Beckwith, the subtitle is Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. There are copies on the book table there in the apologetics section. I saw them. I was asked to come to a Barnes & Noble, which is a book chain in the States, and give a presentation as an author. So you go in and, you know, they set up chairs in the aisle and you talk about your book and then you sign books. Three in my case, but in any event. There was somebody who had been listening to my presentation in one of the other aisles, came over to ask me a question. Now, the book is not about Christianity. It's about relativism, and then it means to defeat moral relativism and then show how this leads to evidence for God's existence. So I don't talk about Jesus at all. But it was clear in maybe some comments or whatever people had asked questions that I was a Christian. And so he had a question of me as a Christian. And his question was, why do I need to believe in Jesus? I'm Jewish, he said. You know, I believe in God. I try to live the best life that I can. He was a religious Jew. He says, so why do I need your Jesus? Now, this is a very important question to be able to answer. And I know how to answer this. A lot of Christians are not able to answer this because of certain things they don't understand about the work of Christ. I'm going to be talking about this in a talk later this week called Credo, the Story of Reality. And because Christians don't understand reality, then they can't answer this question. But so I'm thinking, now how am I going to communicate this to him? And so I said, do you mind if I ask you some questions? He said, no, go ahead. And so now I'm asking questions to get admission from him about certain things that are important for me to make my point that I think he already knows. But he doesn't know he knows it. So I said, first question, do you believe that people who do bad things ought to be punished? And he said, well, since I'm a prosecuting attorney, yes. Now, I happen to get lucky on the fact that he is a prosecuting attorney in the legal system. But most people have this sense, though. They think if you do bad things, you ought to be punished. If you get away without being punished, this isn't justice. This isn't good. So he says, yes, I do. I think they ought to be punished. I said, I agree with you. I think they should be punished. Okay, here's the second question. Have you ever done any bad things? Now, this is a personal question, right? But it's not hard because we're having a friendly conversation. There's no lines drawn and we're not fighting each other. What do you think he said, by the way? Have you ever done any bad things? Yeah. If he had said no, then I would have asked to talk to his wife or his kids, you know. But no, he was honest about it. And I said, so have I. So I'm agreeing with both points. I said, notice where we come just in two questions. We both agree that those people who do bad things ought to be punished, and we both believe that we've done bad things. I said, do you know what I call that? He said, what? I said, I call that bad news. This is not a good situation, right? Now, do I need to tell this man that he's a sinner? No, I don't. Why? Because he already told me, didn't he? Do I need to tell him that he's under judgment? No, he already told me. But he wasn't thinking about it when he walked into the bookstore. These are dispositions that people already have built in because they're made in the image of God. They know these things. Sometimes they think about them, sometimes they don't. But if I ask the right questions, this comes to the surface. Now we're in agreement on these two vitally important things, and now I can work with this. And then I said, well, yeah. So we're both in the dock. We're both, you know, before the judge. And the judge is about to lower his gavel and declare us both guilty as charged and punish us. And we know we deserve it. And it's as if the judge, God, pauses and says, are you guys interested in a pardon? Like a clemency, or, you know, is that, are you interested in that right about? Of course, this makes sense then when somebody already knows they're guilty, which is why I asked the question to begin with. And then I explained to him in very straightforward, non-technical terms about substitutionary atonement, that what God has provided for our forgiveness is that he became a man himself in the person of Jesus to rescue us by taking the punishment for our crimes against God. Actually, I think I told him, I say he took the rap for our sins, and this is vernacular of an idiom from the legal system. That means you take the responsibility for the crime. That's why Jesus is the only way, because he's the only one who paid the price. He's the only one who solved the problem. That's why you need to believe in Jesus. Because if you reject what Jesus offers, you stand alone with your crimes before God, and that's not going to be a pretty picture. So what I did was, is I used the questions to make my point about why Jesus is the only way. Robert?
That was his original question, right?
Why does he need Jesus? Why does he need to believe in Jesus, right? Yes, sir.
One thing, someone challenged me, hey, extraordinary claims need extraordinary fruits. Now, if I ask back, yeah, what's extraordinary for you, what is fruit for you, then we end up somewhere, but anyway, I think the gospel is really unbelievable.
The gospel is what?
It's really unbelievable. If I put together all these, what are the parts of the message? Complex message. God exists, he became human, himself, not us. All these things. It's really an unbelievable issue.
Well, the challenge here is, that is expressed, is people who say, well, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and the Christian worldview is extraordinary on its face. God becomes a man, for example, dies for our sins and these things. I have two responses to that, in substantive. So how this plays out tactically, you'd have to decide in the moment using questions. But the reason that the Christian claims are extraordinary is because people are committed to a materialistic worldview to begin with. I think a materialistic worldview itself is an extraordinary claim that is obviously false. It only is extraordinary to think that there's a God who became a man if you don't believe that gods are even possible in your worldview. It is extraordinary to a secularist, no question, but that's because they've assumed a certain worldview. To say that nothing immaterial exists is so obviously false, I can prove in 60 seconds that this isn't the case. So the complaint is self-serving, is what I'm saying. It's almost to say, well, our claims are extraordinary, is to say, well, yeah, from your point of view, they would be. But if I made the case, for example, as we just did a moment ago, that it is reasonable to believe that something doesn't come from nothing, like the universe, and that there is someone who's responsible for the creating of the universe, then what we've done is we've given an argument that's a legitimate argument to substantiate the first line of our story. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We have quantifiable evidence to show that that's reasonable. In fact, not only is it reasonable, it's the odds on favorite. Now, if it's the odds on favorite that God did create the heavens and the earth, then it is not an extraordinary claim in light of that to say that the same God can enter into human history and to do the kinds of things that Jesus did.
I mean, you're friend, but most people I interpret are from other religions.
Most of the people that you engage are from other religions?
It's not atheist, people like that.
Right.
So if I give it back, okay, and the Krishna consciousness claim is extraordinary for me, or the Buddhist claim is extraordinary for me, and things like that, then we're stuck in the conversation. So it's okay that the burden of proof is not on me, but how to go further from this?
Well, I mentioned that where maybe this will help, and I don't know entirely how to deal with all of the issues here, but let me offer, because you do have a clash of worldviews, and people are, from on the inside of their worldview, already convinced of certain things, looking out into your worldview, and it's different. And so we are making contrary claims. So how do you resolve those? And this is why you've got to kind of go to some of these evidential things. I have no reason to believe, for example, that monism, the monism of Vedantic Hinduism, is true. I don't even know if they have any reason to believe it. No, any substantive reason. I think they inherit this point of view, and they're socialized to believe it. But let me just go back to an earlier comment, and that is that extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. I actually reject that particular equation. I think that extraordinary claims need adequate evidence. Adequate evidence. That claims need adequate evidence. That's all. Claims need adequate evidence. The reason I put it that way is because it's back to this issue of proof. If you agree that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, the other guy's going to say your claims are extraordinary, not his, because he's sitting in his worldview. And there is no evidence that you're going to be able to give that is going to satisfy this requirement of being extraordinary. So I just dismiss it. I just say, I'm not buying that. I'm just saying, if the evidence that you give is adequate to the task, you don't have to call it extraordinary. You just have to show it's reasonable, that's all. And then I think we can do that. So this is another way of stacking the deck against us when they do this. Pardon me? Yeah, I just reject it. They are saying, making a statement that's going to make my job harder on me than it is, and I'm just going to say, no, I'm not going to buy that. Why should I buy that? I think adequate evidence is enough. As long as the evidence is good, if you can show that the evidence favors your side more than the alternate, well, then you've done your job. That's all that's necessary. So I'm not trying to shirk my responsibility to give evidence. I'm just trying not to give him the advantage of being able to dismiss whatever I happen to say. Let me go back to reversing the burden of proof, because I want to talk about two issues here that are important. One I call the professor's ploy. And after I do the professor's ploy, we'll take a break. One is called the professor's ploy. Now, I call this the professor's ploy or trick because professors will use this routinely on students who are Christians. And professors in the States, at least, are usually very happy to criticize Christianity in front of the entire class or anything, to make fun of it, even though they're Christians in the class. It's bad manners. It's not the right way to use a classroom, but they do it a lot. And so what will happen is when the professor says something like, well, the Bible is just a bunch of fables, you're going to have some Christian who's in the classroom who's not going to want to allow that to pass. And he's going to raise his hand, or she's going to raise her hand, and take the professor on in front of the whole class. Now, I think this is right-hearted. I know the motivation behind it, but I think it's wrong-headed, because there's a rule of engagement that governs situations like this, and the rule is that you never make a frontal assault on a superior force in an entrenched position. This is suicidal, because the man with the microphone is going to win. That's the rule. The man with the microphone wins. He's got a position of power. And if you go head-to-head with that person, I wouldn't even do it in that situation. Like I said, I'm a trained professional, but I wouldn't take that chance. Now, I don't say that you have to totally disengage. Just let it go. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying use your tactics instead. So if there was a professor, and you were the student, who said, well, the Bible is just a bunch of fables, what question might come to mind that you might ask the professor? What do you mean by that? You know, first Columbo question. What do you mean by that? Well, then you might get more clarity on the situation, and now you get a clearer understanding. Second question. What? How'd you come to that conclusion? Now, by the way, are those the kind of questions that is appropriate for students to ask? Yeah, of course. This is what students are supposed to do. There's no power struggle there. However, the professor, if you ask questions like that of the professor may figure out what's going on, that you're indirectly challenging his claim. And so what he might do is might say something like this. Oh, you must be one of those Christians who believes the Bible's not a bunch of fables, but it's the Word of God, every jot and tittle. Well, I've got a little time. Why don't you stand up and explain to the rest of the class why you believe the Bible's the Word of God and not a bunch of fables. Go ahead. Now, what has the professor just done? He has reversed the burden of proof from himself to the Christian. Now, why is that wrong for him to do under these circumstances?
He
is the one who made the claim. The Christian didn't make the claim. The Christian just asked a couple questions. There is no burden of proof on a person asking a question because they never make a claim. So if you're in a situation like that, or anyone, where the other person is making the claim and he's basically saying to you, disprove it, don't take the bait. You might say to the professor, well, look at professor, you don't even know what I believe because I never even said it. You know, I'm just a student here. You know, I'm just trying to learn. I just want to know what you believe. Get clear on that and any reasons for it. That's all. So you do not have to be pushed around by the big guys, especially if you're not making any claims. You don't have to be. Even if he says, well, you tell me what you believe, you can just simply say, no, thank you. If you do not feel that you are in a favorable position to give an answer under those circumstances for your own view, then you don't have to take that up. If you ask questions, excuse me, I didn't mean to spit on you. Sorry. I was actually aiming for him and not you.
That's why I sat back.
Yes, that's right. That's why you're one row back there. That's right. There you go. Probably wasn't the first time I did it, but you were so gracious. You didn't even blink. I've lost my train of thought now. If you're the one asking the questions, you bear no burden, and you do not have to accept the burden even when people try to force it on you. Something occurred to me that I ought to mention, and that is, since I began the talk by saying and encouraging you not to try to make harvesting your goal, not to necessarily get right to the foot of the cross or even communicate the gospel necessarily in a conversation, you might be wondering, well, does this guy ever get to the gospel? Where does the gospel come in this method? And so I have a very simple answer for this. The question is, when do you get to the gospel? And the answer is, I get to the gospel whenever I want to get to the gospel. The point is I can assess the circumstances myself to determine how fast or slow I need to go or whether I get to the foot of the cross or not. I am not pressured by some other standard that says in every conversation I've got to try to harvest. Now, like I said, that's controversial, and I've had some very influential people. Josh McDowell, for example, gave me a real hard time on that. But I'm going to stand my ground because I've seen the productivity of it, that it's gotten more people into play. And so it might be that you get into the gospel in 5 minutes. It might be you never get to the gospel, but you get to judge based on your wisdom in the moment that the Holy Spirit gives you how fast to go and how far to go. That's all. It's up to you.
But why Josh McDowell would still be saying,
well, God bless Josh. He's the comment here was for the tape is that that may be more doable in America, but it's certainly not in Europe because there you have the heritage where the words make sense. I don't even think they make that much sense there anymore. Josh's point was you always try, you never know. Well, just because you get somebody to respond and to pray a prayer with you doesn't mean you've gotten a convert. decisions and conversions are different, in my view. And I'm not speaking against anybody else and their habits, and you have to make your own decision before the Lord how you proceed. I just want to give you permission not to have to go there. Look at, I was just thinking of the Philippian jailer, you know. There you have the Philippian jailer in Acts chapter 16 who beholds this miracle, the jail opens up, and then asks Paul, what must I do to be saved? Paul says, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, somebody might point to that and say, well, see, there's the simple gospel. And I'll tell you something. I do not believe that that was the first exposure the Philippian jailer had to the gospel, because it's not enough. He's a Gentile. He has no exposure. He can't even know what these words mean unless there's been prior explanation. And we have a summary there in the book of Acts of things that happened. And I have got to believe, because of the necessity of it, that there was prior conversation with Paul with that man to give him more of the details that he was not persuaded of until the miracle. And when the miracle happened, then he said, what was that again? Can we go over that thing you said again? You know, kind of thing. And he said, believe. And he put his faith and trust and became a Christian. So, you get to the gospel whenever you want, is the point. Now, I told you I was going to share some other benefit of these first two uses of Columbo, gathering information, reversing the burden of proof. What do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? Our questions. And this is what I call getting out of the hot seat. Now, the hot seat is where you find yourself sometimes. The hot seat is where, you find yourself when you're under pressure in a conversation because the other person is much more informed on the issues than you are. So it might be that you are just simply trying to communicate the gospel with the resources you have, and then the person is maybe an academic or a philosopher or a historian or somebody that just has more information than you have, than you're able to deal with. They aren't necessarily overly aggressive with it, but they just know a lot more. And so they may be asking you questions or coming up with evidences that you have no idea how to deal with. Okay, so you're in the hot seat. And these are awkward moments because you might have mustered up the courage to get into a conversation to begin with, and then you discover that you're overmatched. You're in beyond your depth, or different ways of explaining it. And so then you think, gee, I wish I would have never opened my mouth because now I got myself in trouble. Well, not necessarily, because there's a way you can manage the situation. Now, when you are in the hot seat and you have started the conversation in kind of persuasion mode, you want to persuade the other person, and they're coming back with all of this information that you don't know how to deal with. At that point, who is in control of the conversation, you or the other person? Tell me. The other person is, right? You're off balance. You're feeling awkward. You're feeling a little embarrassed. You don't know what to do. You're looking for the door, but, you know, if you're in an airplane, the door is 30,000 feet, you know, this is not good. You're not going anywhere. So how do we get back in the driver's seat? Remember, the tactical approach is for you to be in the driver's seat, okay? Yeah, questions. This is good. So you're onto it now. But there's a very particular way to deal with the situation. Notice that what I said earlier is that when you're in this particular situation, you start off in persuasion mode. You're making your case, and then you're being resisted with superior force of intellect or knowledge or whatever. How do you deal with it? How do you get control back? Very easy, actually. What you do is you have to switch immediately from persuasion mode to fact-finding or information-gathering mode. You switch immediately. And here's the way you do it. You say something, you're hearing all of this, and you say to the person, wow, you know a lot more about this than I do. So you're acknowledging your position of weakness, okay? It's almost like you're exposing your vulnerable underbelly. And you say, you know more about this than I do. Well, maybe you could do me a favor. How about if I stop talking and I'll just listen for a while? And I'm going to get a piece of paper. I just want to take some notes so I understand it. And I wonder if you could just tell me, you know, regarding this issue, could you clearly state your point of view? And then slowly, so I can follow you, you're the teacher, you give me your reasons for it, okay? By the way, did you just hear those two questions? What do you mean by that? And how did you come to that conclusion? That's what it was, right? Okay? Let me listen, okay? Now, by the way, notice, so see, I can see you smiling already because you know something has just happened. What has happened? Control got switched, right? Who's in control now? I'm in control, okay? But in a good way. He's the smart guy. He knows all the stuff, but I'm not the victim anymore. I'm in control. I'm inviting him to come down. Now, I call this like conversational Aikido. You know, Aikido is this self-defense where you use the other person's energy against them. You don't push them back. You welcome them. Come on down. Oh, you want to beat me up? Okay. Come on. Beat me up, but just do it slowly and thoroughly, basically what you're saying. So now, here's how this plays out, though. You ask those two questions, and you let them explain it. And you either make a mental note or you take question. And then you say, okay, now I think I understand. Now let me think about it. Now let me think about it. Now, those are important words. Why are they so important? Because when you say, let me think about it, do you have any responsibility at that point to answer their challenges? No. You already have expressed that you're not up to it. You can't answer the challenge. You're the student, right? And so you are completely off the hook. You start out in a defensive posture because they're coming on. You don't know what to do. You say, mind, just slow down. You know more about this than I do. Just tell me what you believe and why you believe it, and then let me think about it. You're off the hook. So after he's done, then what do you do? Well, what did you say you're going to do? You said you're going to think about it. Well, you have to think about it now. But you can do it on your own, at your leisure, when the pressure is off. And it's a whole lot easier to do that then, because now you got the whole thing. And you can go back to your notes from the conference. You can go to books that you've read. You can go to the internet. You can go to str.org and see if we've got something about the issue. Notice what's happening, though. You're getting an education. You got this tough guy that you're scared of, first off, and now you're using them to your advantage to give you an education about that which you don't know. He's explained it all. He's given his reasons. If he has any good reasons, whatever he has, he's given it to you, and now you got it. And then on your own, you could do whatever research is necessary to resolve this issue. Now, by the way, part of your research is you can call me. You can. I'm not joking. You can call me during office hours. And my office hours are Sundays from 2 to 5 LA time. And I'll give you the phone number. You want to call me? Here. It's where you call. Well, look at this is the 800 number. 1-800-227-5278. That's the 1-800-227-5278. That's the number of the radio show. I get calls from all over the world on my radio show. One Sunday, I got calls from four different continents in one Sunday. Now, this doesn't happen every Sunday. Mostly it's in the States. And frankly, I'm not sure if they're calling 1-800-227-5278, if that's how they got in, or there's also a local number, it's 714 area code, 71475. I don't even know what that is. You have to look it up on the website. I can't remember it. But then I've been saying it for over 20 years, but I still can't recall it now. I got to read it off the sign. But I have people that call me and say, look, I've run into this problem. I'm talking with this person, and here's what he said, or here's what she said, and how do I respond? And so I'll offer the best content that I can offer, and also tactical suggestions about how to maneuver in that circumstance. I often get calls from people who disagree with me. I get calls from atheists on a regular occasion. And if you are listening via podcast, which is free, if you podcast, you can go to iTunes or go to our website and download, and we'll, every Monday you'll get the Sunday broadcast. And you can hear how I deal with the challenger, and what you're going to be able to say is, oh, I know what he's doing. He's using that tactic. He's using the steamroller. He's taking the roof off, or he's using the suicide tactic. I know. I can see what he's doing because, you know, I've been transparent about it with you, and you can see how it plays out in conversation. This is a great advantage to listening to the show, because what you get is not only ideas of what to think, but you'll learn how to think and how to engage at the same time. So I recommend that to you. But you go back, and when you've had been in the hot seat, you turn the tables on them, you get all that information, and you can do this with a computer. You type it all out, and you've got the challenge, and you've got his points, and then when you do your research, you can just add that information. And you know what? With regards to that issue, you've just done your own work. You've got it. It's yours now. And next time it comes up, you're going to be prepared, because you're not going to be the person who doesn't know, and you're going to be able to maybe use Columbo number 3 by using your questions then to make a point, to turn the tables in an appropriate way, to ask him questions or her questions about their particular views that maybe they didn't think about. Now you know some of the liabilities of it. It's just a process. It takes time. But you will be amazed, I promise you. You will be amazed at how much your own ability to engage people will be transformed. And I say this because I've heard so many people from around the world that have called me or have written me or have met me at events like this and say, man, it is such a world of difference now since I've been employing the game plan, what I'm able to do, how I'm able to interact with people, how much easier it is for me, how much more productive it is, how much more friendly the conversations are. These are all things that people have told me simply because they've taken what I've given you here so far and they began to employ it. Now, there are ways you can improve on this. So I want to tell you some ways that you can improve your Columbo technique. It is very difficult to be clever in the middle of a conversation because the pressure's on. You're self-conscious about things, and you're not sure what they're going to come up with, all right? So there are two times, though, when it's easier for you to come up with something clever. And those two times are either before the conversation or after the conversation, right? See how this is blue jeans, blue collar. This is easy, right? Before or after. So one of the things that you may want to do is you may want to anticipate a challenge that might come up. And then think of questions that you might ask in response to them. Now, I told you about Michael Shermer, the debate that I did with him on national radio and in the States. And I knew Michael Shermer was going to raise this issue about who created God. And I knew that it was an intellectually dishonest question. So in the case of Michael, since he's a pro, I could be a little bit more aggressive with him. I didn't mind formulating my response, not only in form of a question, but also formulating it in a way that poked fun at his, it was meant to reveal his intellectual dishonesty a little bit. I don't always do that with people. You can choose, you know, in that situation, it's appropriate. You know, it's a crossfire debate with a professional, and so I wasn't nasty, but I said, you don't believe that God was created. I don't believe that God was created. So why are you asking who created God? None of us believe that. I mean, but it's a question. Notice there's a question that I throw in there. So I thought of that beforehand. So when it came up, I was able to respond. Incidentally, it stands to reason, we send out a newsletter every other month, so 6 a year, and it's called Solid Ground. and it's about 3,000 to 3,500 words, and it's not pictures of our staff, you know, at bake sales or something. It's an article that is meant to help you as an ambassador for Christ. And you can get this on the internet for free. You can sign up for it, and we'll send it to you virtual. And that we also have past issues. On the banner at the top, you'll see drop-down menus. In the banner, you'll see these drop-down menus like this. One of them says resources. And when you drop it down, you'll see one of those says Solid Ground Archives. You have to register, but it's free. It just takes a minute. And then once you sign in, you can just go to all of the archives. But if you go back about 2 years, in January, what I did is I wrote an article about how I prepared for Michael Shermer's debate, which I had done just the month before. And I shared all of my tactical and strategic thinking, how I set myself up, how I prepared this, how I did what I did. And so you can learn from that. But I practiced what I preached. I had an idea of what I was going to face, and so that I thought in advance, what am I going to say? How am I going to maneuver? I didn't always ask questions, and one of the reasons is because when you're on the air in a discussion, if you're not careful and you ask too many questions, you're giving away too much time to the other guy to use up a lot of the time and talk about his own ideas. And I don't want him to have all the time to talk about his ideas. I want to talk about mine. Sometimes you can ask the questions rhetorically. So you make a point with the question, but you're not giving him the chance to talk. Before is one way to deal with it. If you've had problems, issues that have, you're going into a conversation and you're thinking, gee, I hope he doesn't ask that question. Hope he doesn't bring that thing up. Well, that might be a clue that that's some area that you might want to think about in advance and do a little research on and ask a few and develop a few questions. Sometimes you learn what you don't know by the encounter. And so it's after the encounter that you're looking back and you're saying, oh, man, I'm glad that's over with. Gee, I wonder what I could have done better. Now, I do this all the time. I don't just do this with myself. I do this with staff members who happen to be party to the conversation or maybe to the radio show or to the debate or whatever it happened to be. And I wonder to myself, gee, what could I have done better with that particular challenge? Could I have thought of a question? Or can I think of it now, that next time this comes up, I could improve on. So it's the same idea as anticipating, but now I'm just reflecting. And when you do either, anticipate or reflect, before or after, and you come up with something, role play it. Practice it out loud with yourself or with someone else. I do this all the time. I'm driving down the freeway, and I'm just talking. And now you can do this. People don't think you're nuts because they think you're on the telephone, you know. But a lot of times I will be listening to a radio show and somebody says something, and so I'll turn the show off and I'll respond. And I'm just thinking how I would say it, and I try to put it in words, and I say it out loud. And saying it out loud has an effect. It has the ability of fixing it in your mind a little bit. It gives you more confidence because you've already said it. And so you're more comfortable with doing it next time. Sometimes my wife, you know, I'll just start talking, and she knows that I'm thinking out loud and I'm practicing. When I'm driving to the radio show with Melinda, it's almost a 2-hour drive for me to get there, an hour and 45 minutes, but I pick up Melinda halfway. And we'll chitter-chatter about stuff, and then I'll start thinking about issues, and I realize that I start talking more in radio mode, not radio voice, but I'm working through issues, and I'm just warming up for when I get on the air and, oh, what if they ask this? I'm going to open up with these comments, and then I'm saying them to Melinda because it's giving me a chance to practice it beforehand. So when I get on the air, even with my opening monologue, and I usually spend about 20 minutes just opening about something. Who knows, maybe in a couple of weeks I'll be talking about you guys. You never know. But is there anybody here that listens to the radio show just out of curiosity? Dan, do you? I mean, Paul?
God. Can we get it hungry?
You can get it anywhere on the internet.
On the internet.
Yeah. How many names have I called you so far?
Call him John.
Yeah, I know. I already apologized for
actually,
that.
My middle name is Dan.
Gosh.
Mark doesn't get mad too easily.
He's got a name tag, no less, but his name tag's facing the wrong direction, so I can be forgiven for that. But anyway, Paul. My middle name is Paul, so I should. And we're having coffee tomorrow morning too, so easy. But yeah, you can get the podcast anywhere in the world, unless it's blocked in your country, which I don't know, Romania maybe. I don't know. Who's Romanian?
No,
there's no, no problems there. Nobody here from Red China, so maybe Albania. Albania's closed, isn't it? I don't know. Anyway, I think you can get it. But there's nobody here. Okay, nobody here listens. See, I can make like 12 new converts here to the show. I think you'll find it. It's only 3 hours a week, so it's doable. It's manageable amount.
So just a little bit about the program. So you do a 20-minute monologue, and then people start calling in based upon how you introduce.
Yeah, it's caller driven, so it doesn't have to be on the monologue. Actually, usually people are queuing up before. So I'll have five or six people quickly waiting to talk to me about something else that's on their mind. They're not reacting to the monologue. So there is a style of radio where you do every hour you do a different topic. That's called news talk. And so you take something out of the news and you pump it up and then you get people reacting to it, you know. But this is not what I do. And so I get a full range of different challenges and questions and issues. And
you get Christians and non-Christians.
Yes, a mix. More Christians than non-Christians, but I do get a mix. And so the majority are Christians who are asking for advice on how to deal with something. And then occasionally I'll get Christians who disagree with me on a theological issue or how I happen to play out some apologetics things, so we have a disagreement. Or I'll have atheists that will come in and challenge me. But I have a lot of atheists that like listening to the show because they appreciate that I'm kind to the callers and I'm careful about my thinking and I really try to get at the answers. So anyway, I commend it to you. This is a good way to learn. So that's how to get out of the hot seat. I'm trying to think of where I'm at because I'm a little bit scattered in my presentation here this afternoon. Any more questions about what we've covered so far? We've talked about three uses of Columbo, and I talked about avoiding the trap, the professor's trap, the professor's ploy, and also about getting out of the hot seat by using those two questions. Yeah.
Do you ask questions?
Paul!
Do you ask questions if people have questions to collect your thoughts if you're scattered in your presentation?
Say that again?
Do you ask people?
It must be funny because everybody's laughing, but I didn't get it.
Do you ask people?
Yes.
Do you have questions?
Yes.
If in your presentation you're somewhat scattered.
Oh, you know, just to buy a little time. Usually, I'm not scattered. So I don't have to bail out on that. And that isn't what I was doing there, but I was just I was trying to remember all the things that we'd kind of covered, and I still have a couple more things that I need to do. But I want to make sure that I catch any strays here that are still like, yes?
I'm curious. It seems like this is based somewhat on the assumption that people will be rational or that you'll exploit where they're not rational.
Sure.
But what about when you just get the which is quite common, the purely just emotional argument that goes, I don't say the evil and suffering question. I don't care if there's a rational explanation that proves God or at least tips the hand towards God. I just don't like the evil and suffering, so whether God exists or not, I want nothing to do with it. You know, kind of that just, it's so just going to defer.
So you want nothing to do, okay, I'm just, I need some clarification here, okay? So is your complaint that you're so upset about evil and suffering that it makes you not care about the God question? Or are you upset enough that you want an answer that might help you solve practical issues? What is it?
Probably the first one.
Incidentally, notice how I'm employing the tactic. Lots of ambiguity in the challenge. So I say, what do you mean by that is what I'm trying to figure out.
Right.
So do you have more to say about that? You just be the guy here for the sake of a discussion. You don't have to be nasty, but let's just role play it. You have somebody in mind. You have something. The person who is just purely emotive.
Yeah, or
the true postmodern that just doesn't, you can explain all you want to explain, but I don't buy it. You know,
When you say you don't buy it, you mean it doesn't matter what I say, you're not going to believe anything? No matter what reason I offer?
I don't buy the basis of reason as a legitimate starting point.
Why not?
I don't feel like I can role play it adequately.
Okay, no, that's all right. But see, no, fair enough. But your silence is not unusual.
Right.
Okay, your silence is not unusual. But this is a fair question to ask them. The person who's a postmodernist almost always is going to offer at some level rational objections to your point of view, and then they're going to switch the rules and play the postmodern, there is no truth thing, nobody can know anything, it's a linguistic game, or however they want to play this out. So what they're doing is just cheating. So I'm going to at least ask of them a little bit of an accountability there. Mm-hmm. You know, are when they say they're not buying it, are they saying that they have a different linguistic game they're playing, their narrative is different than mine, and I have my narrative and they have their narrative, and that's all you can say, and they like their narrative better than mine? Maybe that's what they mean, but I want to have them try to play that out. What makes you think it's only a narrative? That would be a fair question of a postmodern, because what they're doing is they're trying to say there is no truth to the matter, there are just competing stories. But of course, that's a way of explaining the truth of the matter, isn't it? They are giving a realist characterization of their view. They're saying, this is the way reality really is. It's just a bunch of stories. Well, wait a minute. How am I supposed to take that statement? Am I supposed to take your statement that it's a bunch of stories as just a story? Or is this a characteristic of reality? Are you characterizing reality accurately? So this is, the suicide is working in here. Point making is, I'm not just going to roll over and play dead. I got lots of questions that I want to ask, even about that kind of thing. Look at, if people are just completely emotional and they don't even want to talk, well, there's not much I can say to them. That young man at that dinner table, he was like that. He was just completely belligerent, wasn't interested in having any kind of reasonable discussion. He just wanted to be mad and reject God and just blow it off and maybe posture in front of his dad or whatever was going on. So some people you can't talk to. And I'm the guy who wants to talk to the people who wants to talk to me. If a person doesn't want to talk to me, why should I waste my time? If they want to just blow me off, you know, and just, wow, again, that's Americanism, but they just want to dismiss me, well, what can I do? You know, some people can't even, you know, they say you lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Well, some horses you can't even lead to water. All right, well, then find another horse. The world is full of other horses, you know. So there is no silver bullet. There's no magical thing that you can do that's going to be the kind of thing you can just transfer every circumstance into a productive conversation. Because life isn't like that. I will sometimes, I probably won't have time for it now, but unless maybe we'll do a little bit of it towards the end, but a lot of times I'll take a half an hour and do a role play with the audience. You know, so you guys be the secularist or whatever you want to be, and you begin throwing challenges or whatever at me, and then I do my best to employ the tactics and answer the questions. But what I say before we do this is, don't expect everything to be tidy and perfect and for me to be flowing with these beautiful responses, you know, because it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes there's loose ends. Sometimes it's you don't have just the perfect thing to say. That's because life is not tidy. And sometimes it's herky-jerky. You know, you move forward a little bit, then you move back, whatever. But it's okay, because it's the Holy Spirit that is the one that's ultimately making the changes in people's lives. And so if we expect it all to be kind of perfect, then we're going to be disappointed. And you'll be disappointed with me, because I'm not always that perfect. Go ahead, Robert.
I heard a great illustration when we were together in London, or in Le Brie. How do you get a horse to drink who doesn't want to drink? How do you lead? You can lead a horse to water, but you can't get him to drink.
You can salt his feet or something.
Salt, or you can ration. you know, this water is just really good, but there's some arguments that will never work for the postmodern. So the person said, well, then you just get a group of horses drinking that just really love the water. You know, and so yeah. It's not an argument, it's a relational thing that yeah. The postmodern sees the Christians, mm-hmm. that they're just really enjoying mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But even for the postmodern, I think he's going to have to come to grips with false views of reality. And the postmodern view is a false view of reality. I've actually written, because there is a tendency to talk about postmodern Christianity and the emergent church and all of that other stuff, that if you are a postmodern, that is, if you hold that there is no knowledge, there's no truth, different ways to characterize it, then you can't be a Christian. Because to be a Christian, you have to believe in Jesus. And belief in Jesus is a holding that certain things are true about Jesus. And if you deny that there can be things true, then you deny the possibility of the kind of belief that Jesus himself requires for salvation. So at some point, there's going to have to be a shift in that. But the ally that we have is that human, and this I get from Francis Schaeffer, is that human beings actually are made in the image of God. And they have to live in the world that God made. And therefore, even with the postmodern sentiments, they are still going to be running into the real world, and that gives us a resource. I talk about that in the book on the chapter on taking the roof off. But let me offer one other thought. Let me talk about a different tactic. We've talked now. I think you've got a picture of the game plan. We've got some illustrations going, and you've got a feel for how this can work. And let me emphasize, too, how important it is for you to put this into play immediately. Even with people here in the conferences, you're having conversations. Just start asking questions. Draw them out. Get to know their points of view and why they believe it. Be good practice. And then immediately when you get home with people that you know that you've been trying to talk with, begin taking a different posture, a questioning posture, to be able to lay a foundation for more effective conversation. But sometimes you're going to run into people who will engage you in conversation, and they'd be happy to do so as long as they can be in control of everything. And in fact, these kind of people are unpleasant people because I call them steamrollers because they steamroller, you know what a steamroller is? That big machine, that big heavy thing that rolls pavement out, okay? They make roads with this big, and you feel like you're getting overwhelmed by this person because of the force of their personality, because how loud they are, how aggressive they are, and how much they talk. In fact, a steamroller will offer a challenge to you and won't let you answer. Because the minute you start to answer, they're going to interrupt and they're going to offer another challenge or take exception with what you're saying before you even are able to explain it, and they're going to take you off in another direction. And if you allow it to happen, that person is going to be pulling you all over the place and you'll never be able to say anything intelligent. They're in charge of the conversation and they're abusing the control that they have over the conversation. Now, I think we should be in charge of the conversation, but we don't abuse it. We give the other person opportunity, especially by asking questions. But steamrollers abuse it. They are people who like power. They like being in control. They're generally men, but not always. And some of you may be married to steamrollers, you know. This is a very unfortunate situation. If you are going to have an effective conversation with that person, you're going to have to learn how to control that person. And so we have a tactic called the steamroller tactic, which is a defensive tactic. You do not want to be a steamroller. It's a defensive tactic, and there's really three steps to dealing with a steamroller. And each of these steps are progressive. That is, if you take the first step and you solve the problem, you don't have to go any further. If first step doesn't work, you go to the second step. And if you go, that doesn't work, you go to the third step, and there is no fourth step. And you'll see why when I tell you what the third step is. First step with a steamroller, that is a person who's constantly interrupting, is you stop them gently and you negotiate. Now, this can happen very easily if somebody's jumping in a lot. Robert, he's just always, I'm trying to talk, and hold on, Robert, wait, I'll be done in just a minute. Let me answer your question and then I'll let you back in. It's just a simple thing like that. A little body language here. A willingness to participate in a conversation, but a request to at least respond. This is an important issue you've brought up. Can I take a few seconds and answer it when I'm done? Then I'll let you have the floor. Now, that's a very reasonable request for equal time. Steamrollers take advantage of the fact that it's easier to ask the hard question than to listen to the hard answer. People often will say to me, I got a short question. You know, I'm in a hurry. You know, I'm just leaving an event. They're about to lock the doors. Oh, don't worry, it's a short question. Of course, the short questions aren't the problem. It's the long answers that are the problem. The questions are easy to ask. The answers aren't always easy to give briefly because of the complexity of the issue. And a lot of people don't have the patience to listen because they don't want an answer. Steamrollers are disingenuous. They don't really want to play fair. They want to be in control. It's a power thing for them. And so now there are some exceptions. Some people are just excitable. But wait, you know. And so they're, I call them benevolent steamrollers. They just jump in and they're not mean spirited. They're just impatient. And so hold on just a minute. We'll get to your question. So the first step is just to stop them, do a mild kind of negotiation, and then move forward. And if they jump in again, you say, hold on, I'm not quite done. Or if maybe you finish and then they talk and then it's your turn again and they jump in again, you have to do this again. It's okay. If they cooperate, you're in good shape. If you stop them and that works, then you're covered. Just move on in your conversation. Now, some people are too aggressive. And just simply stopping them in that way and negotiating is not adequate. They still press. And in fact, some people are so aggressive that you can't even do the first step. And so if the first step doesn't work, or you can't even get a word in edgewise to get to this first step, then you just wait until they stop talking. And then you move directly to the second step. The first step is you stop them. The second step is you shame them. Now, shaming them is much like the first step, except for it's a more explicit request for courtesy. So you're going to address the discourteous interruption directly. So, Paul.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Steamroller number two.
Yeah. Paul, I'd love to answer your question, but it's hard for me because you keep interrupting. And it makes me think that you don't really want an answer. So, if you really would like to have an answer, give me a few moments to answer the question. When I'm done, I'll let you respond. Is that okay with you? Now, some of you are going, oh man, that's a little bit extreme. Well, it is a little extreme because Paul's an extreme steamroller, right? And so with stronger people, you have to deal with them more directly. Incidentally, if you would have taken that posture initially, this would be a little bit much. If somebody had just a little broken in and I said, will you please, you know, that kind of thing, then I'm out of line. But if I've already given them a chance and they've broken trust with me and now it's getting out of hand, I have a choice. I've got to do something and take control of the conversation for some good purpose, or I just have to break it off entirely because this isn't going anywhere. And so it's appropriate then to be more aggressive. And so to say to somebody, and in your notes I probably have a couple of little dialogues that are examples of how you might proceed. And I've done all of these different things at different times. And occasionally on the radio, I've had to actually pot somebody down, take their volume off, and just let them know. I said, this is the way it's going to be. It's my radio show. And you can ask the question, then I'm going to respond, and then it's your turn to respond. And if this isn't sufficient for you, or if this isn't something you want to do, then this phone call's over. So, what's it going to be? Then you can talk. Are you in or out? By my rules, or whatever. It's an appropriate request, because if you don't do something like that with people at this stage, you're not going to get anywhere. So your first step is to stop them. Second step is to shame them. What if that doesn't work? Third step?
Shoot them.
Shoot them. You leave them. You leave them. You break off the conversation, it's over with. You refuse to go forward. When I say leave them, I don't mean divorce your husband. I just mean you abandon that particular conversation. It's just not worthwhile anymore. And some people do not deserve an answer. It's just that simple. Jesus said, don't throw pearls before swine. Don't throw what is holy to dogs. Now, he's not calling people dogs or pigs. He is saying that there are certain circumstances. By way of metaphor, he's saying there are certain circumstances in which it is not appropriate for you to give the good stuff to certain folks. Now, how do you know when you reach that point? Well, Jesus says, lest they, how does he put it? They turn on you, they trample it underfoot and turn on you and tear you to pieces. I think it's the way he puts it, right? Well, if you get a sense that you're dealing with somebody who's starting to trample your stuff underfoot and they're about to turn on you and verbally tear you to pieces, it's entirely appropriate to walk away from that conversation. Remember, you are in charge of your half of the conversation. That's all right. Jesus did not give everybody an answer. Some people he answered very straightforwardly. Some people answered in a mystical kind of way. I mean, in a parable. And what's that? What's going on with him? Why did he say that? Do you ever have that when you read the Gospels? You think, why did Jesus say that? It's so confusing. I can't figure out. He's the hardest guy in the whole Bible to understand, I think. So everybody doesn't deserve an answer. Sometimes you have to walk away. That's okay. Because you weren't going to get anywhere with that person anyway. So that's how you deal with steamrollers. In short, I think there's more in your notes. You can check that out. There's a whole chapter on it in the book. We have a little bit more time. And I'm not sure how you'd like to use the time. If you want to ask some questions, you can do that. Or maybe we'll have some role play, like you said. Or maybe you want to go into some other things. Robert.
You had mentioned that you were going to go in to take the roof off. Now, say, well, this is your worldview then?
No, the question is when I'm asking questions to get a person to talk about their point of view, I'm really getting at worldview issues. Somewhat that is true. Do I ever kind of peg them as one thing or another? I don't find that I'm trying to do that. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, I guess, a couple of different things. I'm trying to get a person to reflect on reality and their fit of reality to the worldview that they claim is true. Okay, so if you're for example, if you're a materialist, you're going to have a hard time making sense of morality. Okay, and in the last century, the atheists were intellectually honest in that they were willing to bite the bullet and admit that if God doesn't exist, then morality is a fiction. And the more careful philosophical atheists, like Michael Ruse, for example, will admit this now. But the new atheists are not philosophically sophisticated. The Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and the Daniel Dennett's and the Sam Harris's, and they are not sophisticated at all. They don't know the way the philosophical rules work. And so what they want to say is they want to be moral realists, that is, believe in objective morality on the one hand, but then deny God's existence on the other hand. And the way they almost always will explain morality is through Darwinian evolution. Okay? Now, I can't go into detail on this now because it's a little bit complex, but the two don't fit. You cannot believe in Darwinian evolution as a source of morality and believe in objective morality at the same time, because Darwinism cannot produce objective morality, period. What it can produce is the illusion of morality, if anything. And Michael Ruse will point that out. But he said, it's the illusion. It's not the real thing. But people like Michael Shermer believe that it produces the real thing. And so what I'm going to be trying to do in that situation is I'm going to be trying to point out that your worldview is not adequate to this thing that you believe is true about the world, which is true, that the world is a moral world. my worldview is adequate for it, yours isn't. And for me, this is where Francis Schaeffer comes in. So let's use this as a bridge to talk about the taking the roof off tactic, which is one of the tactics in the book, and it's a tactic that the terminology is Schaefferian. It's from Schaeffer himself. But I have to tell you a little bit about the way Schaeffer understands the task of defending the faith. There's a lot to what Schaeffer has to offer, but one thing that impressed me the most is that he says that if Christianity is true, then the depiction of the world in the Bible is the accurate depiction of the world. It's the way the world really is. It's a picture of reality. Therefore, the world is made by God the way God made it. That's true. And human beings are made in the image of God. These are fixed realities. Now, what about the person who denies those things? Well, if those things are true, and you have a secularist who denies both of those things, that means he is going to be living with beliefs that are not consistent with reality. And sooner or later, his false beliefs are going to run headlong into the way the world actually is. And it's actually sooner, not later. In fact, it's virtually instantaneous. Because it turns out that secularists hold all kinds of convictions about the way the world is that don't make any sense whatsoever in the context of their worldview, materialism, but fit perfectly in the worldview of Christianity. So Schaeffer basically argues that that Christians have reality as an ally on their side. And you can always count on a non-Christian to know certain things to be true, even though he may not want to admit it. And remember the questions I asked of the attorney. Do you think that people who do bad things ought to be punished? Have you done bad things? What was I doing there? I was trading on certain knowledge I had of intuitions that were built into that human being, that if he wasn't defending his own turf, if I just asked the question, he'd answer truthfully because he knows better. People don't answer truthfully when they're protecting something, but if you catch them off guard, they'll answer truthfully. And part of our job, Schaeffer would say, is to be alert for when people are giving two messages or when they are saying something that is at conflict with the way reality as they know it to be actually is. Now, he called this reality running into false beliefs the point of tension. And it's at that point you can exploit the contradiction in their own thinking. Now, this sounds like all philosophical, but it's not actually that tricky. Because this is what happened when I was doing with Gil, the physical therapist. He was saying that it's wrong to judge because he was a knee-jerk relativist, all right? But he knew better deep down inside that the world is a moral universe and there are some things that are wrong and we can pass judgment on them legitimately. And that's why he was judging me for passing judgment, because there was a certain, for part of him that made sense. That was the part that was honest with reality. But then his relativism was asserting itself too. And so what did I do? I saw the point of tension, and I asked some questions about that, and there he was going, wow, wait, you got me all confused. No, you're confused already. You believe contradictory things. People say things like this: there is no morality. There's no objective morality. It's all relative. Therefore, it's wrong for you to push your morality on me. You notice what just happened there? There is no morality. Here's one. Morals are relative. It's objectively wrong for you to push your morality on me. That's the way they mean the statement. So they're saying a contradictory thing right in the same breath. Okay. Now, this broad understanding that I just described is key to understanding how taking the roof off as a tactic works. Because taking the roof off is a way in which you expose this point of conflict, point of tension. And what you do tactically is you accept the other person's point of view for the sake of argument. Basically, you're going to say, okay, let's say you're right on your view of things. You're right. So I'm going to get into your car the worldview car, and let's give it a drive, and let's see where it takes us. And so you try to show where the view leads if it's lived out consistently. This is also called, under certain circumstances, a reductio ad absurdum, or reducing to the absurd. You take the point of view and you carry it out. So homosexuals are arguing for same-sex marriage. Why? Because we should be allowed to marry those who we love. Or we just want to be treated fairly. Or there's a whole host of other ways that they try to justify this. I'm not taking the issue on itself, but I just want you to think about the justification. Given that justification, what is the, any of those, what then would be the principled argument against polygamy? Or polyandry, more than one husband, or polyamory, like a whole group married to each other? Now, I know the response that those defending same-sex marriage are going to give, and here's what they say. They say, that's ridiculous. And my response is, you're right. It is ridiculous, but it follows from your view. Because the same reasoning that you're applying to justify this also justifies this. And if this is ridiculous, then why isn't it a ridiculous justification of your own? That's taking the roof off.
That isn't considered ridiculous anymore.
Pardon me? In Europe, that
was... Well, in some European countries, that's been the direct consequence of gay marriage.
Same-sex marriage.
Same-sex marriage.
There's a difference, by the way.
Sorry.
Government doesn't care what your sexual preference is. It cares what your gender is.
Yeah. So, but in some countries, so polygamy is now on the agenda.
Yes, well, yeah. And the part of the problem nowadays is it's hard to parody anything, because if you try to give an extreme example of carrying the, they'll say, well, that's okay. We like that too. You know, so that things are getting so extreme. But in the States, this is still a hot button. Polygamy is still a hot button. And so the same-sex marriage crowd does not want to go there. They don't want to admit this. But if they're to be intellectually honest, the same arguments that justify this with the same force. And if this isn't legitimate, if this is ridiculous, polygamy, polyamory, then this should raise a question about how effective that argument is to justify same-sex marriage as well. So this can be a forceful way of arguing if people are intellectually honest, but they're not always intellectually honest. This is one of the things that Paul and I were talking about.
So how do you follow on from that argument, this is ridiculous?
Which particular argument?
So when you say, you know, what about those extreme cases, and they'll say, but that is ridiculous.
Well, what makes it ridiculous is the question that I would ask them. I mean, I agree that it's ridiculous. But keep in mind, those cases are equally justified by their rationale. If they're putting one rationale forward, the same rationale, if it's a rationale with integrity, it should equally apply to other circumstances, okay? And if it doesn't apply equally, then it sounds like it's self-serving. It's a special pleading or something like that. And I think that's what's going on. I don't think that homosexuals care about being good and right and fair. I think homosexuals want to be homosexuals, and they want approval for their behavior, and that's all that matters to them. That is the truth of the matter. And all of this moral language is just a smokescreen to try to sanitize their own commitment to do what they want to do. That's really what's going on here.
The difficulty with that argument, which I've often come across, is they then feel stigmatized to being judged on, you know, more extreme things, and you're comparing their action, which they think is okay, to being a more extreme one. And
well, what is the extreme thing? Polygamy?
So whatever else you choose, or, you know.
Well, you know, I'm sorry if they feel stigmatized by the judgment.
Yeah.
I think personally, what I just told you a moment ago, what I think is really going on, is not something that I say in the public square, because it's not effective. I'm giving you an insight that I think this is what's going on. These are people in rebellion against God. I've had actually one person on the air admit this to me, one homosexual. But I think this is really what's going on. And so it informs our judgment, our assessment of the circumstance. It doesn't inform our tactical approaches so much. You know, I mean, we don't say this isn't our argument kind of thing. But sometimes I understand the sensitivity that homosexuals have regarding being stigmatized as doing something wrong. Why isn't it? But let me just ask you again, on the inside the group here. It's so interesting to me how the politicized effect of these moral issues have influenced how we look at things. The poor homosexual who's being stigmatized. Well, my response is, why don't you grow up? Well, you're stigmatizing me. People stigmatize Christians up and down without any bit of embarrassment at all. Am I standing there going, oh, I'm so stigmatized. People think that I'm so narrow-minded and arrogant and judgmental and you know, well, I'm not whining because I'm not deeply offended because somebody thinks that I'm wrong.
The difficulty that I see in Europe is we just don't, well, this is maybe out of a conversation context, but for example, dealing with the press,
I agree with you, and that's why I said among this group, I'm trying to give you my inside take on these kinds of things, but when we deal with these things, we have to be very, very circumspect because we're dealing with children. We're dealing with people who look at the world like children. You have to believe like I believe. You have to say what I want to hear. Everything's got to be just right, and if not, we're going to have a tantrum, and we've got a press that's going to cooperate with us. And we're going to say, by the way, in the process, that you're the one who's hating us. Yeah. Thursday, I'm giving a talk called The Intolerance of Tolerance. Yeah. And I talk about how this plays itself out. Is it Thursday? No, Thursday is over with. Maybe it's Wednesday I'm giving this talk in the afternoon. The Intolerance. And I'm going to show a picture from the LA Times. And the headline says, gay rights groups object to vicious treatment or vicious... something like that, you know. So then there's two pictures, okay? And there's this picture of these people with signs and angry faces and like that. And that's the gay rights group. Well, who are the vicious people opposing being so intolerant? And there's a picture in the bottom of five Russian old women in babushkas sitting on a park bench. In protest of gay rights or whatever. And they're the awful, demonized people. See, this happens all the time. It is the left that is vicious and unaccepting and condescending and name-calling and challenging. And occasionally the right will do something like that. And those guys get the headlines. But most of the people on the right, the religious right or whatever, aren't like that. But the press always plays it that way. Just like you said, you find one little thing. And so the press cooperates with this. And we have to deal with that. But this is a reality of working in a highly secularized culture. I just take it as rank insecurity. I actually had one homosexual wrote in a letter to the editor, and he said this. He says, why can't we just have the courage of our own convictions? Why can't we just let people disagree and not have a fit? If we really believe what we believe, why can't we do that? It was a refreshing comment. But the reality is very different. This is an uphill battle for us to fight, but I think this is a place where we're going to... it's important for us to stand our ground, I think, sometimes. And I don't deal with policy issues in the public square, so I don't... You know, but I imagine if I were in a circumstance, and sometimes I've been that way, I just want to simply say, look, you're calling me hateful. What have I done that has been hateful? I've said that you're wrong, but you're saying that I'm wrong. So what's the difference here? Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to be persuaded by that necessarily, but I think that's an honorable way of responding. I don't think full-on retreat is an honorable way of responding. But I don't think insensitive attacks are honorable either. I think speaking the truth in love is the kind of the right kind of balance. But I know you can't do that. You can't speak the truth in love without being marginalized. But this is where I think we have a place where we can fight against the attempt at marginalizing. I say, you look at the picture. Who's being the nasty guys here? You know, or whatever. It's a terrible, difficult battle. And... it is a place where the forces are darkest, it seems to me, against Christians. And it's got to get worse. But Now, especially as same-sex marriage gets legalized, this is a legal way of saying that there's no distinction between same-sex unions and heterosexual unions. They're exactly the same as far as the law is concerned. And then you have a legal lever, a club to use against people of conscience who think there's a difference, because now they can be prosecuted. And this is on its way, and in some countries it's already in play.
And then
the difficulty, the problem, if we go the direction of no state marriage, to me that's a capitulation that's dangerous, because the state is there, ordained by God, for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do good. It is meant to secure protection of goodness and to establish justice. One of the things that it's important, there are three institutions that God has ordained to protect us from the impact of the fall. One of them is the church. Another is the government. Another one is the family. These work together when working properly, so that the government has policy positions to protect the family. And when the family is protected by the government and reinforced by the church, then there is less evil in the world, especially with regards to children. When any of those cease doing their job, there's more evil in the world. So if the government were to back out of doing marriages and it's just whatever, then you've lost a significant preserving force on the vital institution of marriage and family, because marriages start families, and families are the foundation of culture. All of a sudden, the government has said, we're not going to privilege families or protect families anymore, because families don't even exist as far as we're concerned. This can bring nothing but evil to our communities. And that's why I don't think backing out and giving in, even though the pressure is strong, is going to be the right thing to do. But it is a very complicated problem to deal with. I don't think it's intellectually complicated. I think it's pragmatically complicated. Well, we're almost out of time. Let me offer just kind of a parting thought here. In the book, which I've already taken back, the last chapter of the book, and I hope you get a copy of it. There's a stack of them there, and they already bought them, so I already got my royalty. So it doesn't help me for you to buy from them, you know. But it will help you. And the last chapter is titled "More Sweat, Less Blood." Now, I get this phrase from a training motto from the Marine Corps, the U.S. military Marine Corps. And their motto is, during training, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. The more you sweat in training, the less you bleed. I like that. In fact, I think of this whenever I have an occasion to be up against a formidable opponent in a public sector, like Michael Shermer, for example, or Deepak Chopra. I did a one-hour TV debate, national TV debate, with Deepak Chopra, who's arguably the number one, actually, I don't even know who his competition would be, New Age guru in the world, 20 million books. Anyway, I think of this. I think, okay, I'm going into battle, and I could bleed really badly, because battles are dangerous, even these kinds of battles. So, you know, blood is shed. And I'm not physically right now in our country, but it's hardship. And I want to be effective for the cause of Christ. I want to make a difference. And so I am encouraged by the motto to spend the time that I need to spend in sweating beforehand, so that when I'm in the confrontation, I'm not bleeding all over the place. They might take some blood, but I'm going to try to minimize that so that I can do the best job that I can do. That's not just for me as, in a sense, a professional. That is something for every Christian warrior, for every ambassador for Christ. This session here was just an introduction to some concepts. And I hope I said some things that were memorable and gave you some illustrations that maybe you can use, but more than anything, I hope that I've given you a framework that you actually begin to employ in your everyday life as an ambassador. Because whether you like it or not, or whether you know it or not, you already are an ambassador. You're already communicating something about the God you represent. Whether you do a good job or bad job depends entirely on you and your willingness to sweat more in training so that you bleed less in battle. I, for one, have been privileged to be able to spend some time with you, to talk about some of these things and pass these things on. And and I entrust them to you in the name of the Lord. And I'd like to pray for you just as we finish, if that's okay. Thank you, Father, for this fine group of people in this fine conference, in my opportunity to be able to pass something on as an older brother to them, so that they can be more effective as your ambassadors. Lord, it is not an easy situation in our cultures, and the European culture is much different, more difficult even than the secular culture in the States. And I don't take that lightly. I know that they're facing a much harder challenge than what I face, but I ask that you would take the things that I've offered, this game plan, the Colombo tactic, this tactical approach, all of the things that I've talked about, that you would build these things into their lives and that they would shine for Christ wherever it is that you take them. For Christ's sake and the kingdom's sake. Amen. Thank you so much for the time we've had together today.